Geçince niye sımın aladın ya?
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, generals, good morning. There is some refreshments outside. Please help yourself, otherwise SAPS will have to pay for that refreshment. And we're going to call it wasteful expenditure. But welcome to our committee, but help yourself to some refreshments outside, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to start shortly.
Yes.
fellow, how do I know if this thing is on? So he said, let me see. He's drinking.
Is there any trouble to show on the next
book because
they're still doing it?
That's what I'm saying. But if they're going to see it, it's
going to
be there.
Yes, it is. On
the way.
I'm
going to
No, I
was going to speak to you. My laptop is just that. I have to use the laptop. I have to use that laptop because I cannot come and hear. And I'm sitting over the phone. As I thought of asking you.
I was asking you.
He said I should speak to you. I apologize. No. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah.
Great. Well, you can see the
you long day today.
Yes, but I'm interested. It doesn't fit.
Oh, okay.
This thing knocks it out.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I hope you had your tea and some refreshments, as we don't want you to say to us tomorrow that we didn't share. That is a people's parliament, that is an activist parliament, and that is a sharing parliament. So, because when we get to you, you always share with us, so we just want to repay the debt. I think we are still waiting for the Department of Energy, but in the meantime, while they are not here, we will continue with the program. The TDG, we're still waiting on him. Am I right? Okay, he's on his way. You know, the traffic in Cape Town, it is terrible, and so people sometimes must judge them with times and that, specifically with the traffic. But we've got Major General Sibiya here and Major General Luke. Generals, good morning and welcome to Parliament. Welcome to everybody in the room. And we hope we're going to have a fruitful meeting today. But before we proceed, let's introduce ourselves. because we don't want to know who's or read tomorrow or hear tomorrow that an informed source or someone has said to us, a reliable source has said that this has happened and that has happened. You want to know who's who. My name is Freddie Adams. I'm the chairperson of the Select Committee on Economic Development, which comprises or which has got oversight over the Department of Energy, Mineral Resources, and Economic Development. So that's the three departments that we've got oversight over. And we are just exercising. I'm from the Western Cape, permanent delegate of the province of the Western Cape. Let me start from this side, Madam.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Dave Abrams, and I'm from Gauteng. Thank you.
Good morning, everybody. I'm from the Eastern Cape, Elsa Sandlingen.
Good morning. My name is Colin Maier. I'm from Norfolk.
Before you get comfortable, sir, just introduce yourself.
Morning. Kenneth Sinclair, Northern Cape.
Chris Nathan, National Executive Committee, SALGA.
Gail Eddy, SALGA Parliamentary Office.
Shanti Abubakar, Business Report.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I'm General Sibia from the Directorate of Private Crime Investigation in Gauteng. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair. I'm Major General Luke from the Police Media Services. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair. My name is Tulofela Molefe from Eskom.
Good morning, Chair. Chusa Chew from Eskom.
Good morning, Chair. Andrew Essinger from Eskom.
Morning, Chair.
Sibo
Maputi from
Genki. Morning, Chair and members. Mapelo Mvunelwa, Eskom.
Good morning. Ibrahim Hendricks from Telkom.
Good morning, Chair and the committee. Nontlanhla Ndebele from the Department of Energy.
Good morning. I'm Nosi Jiwo Dinuzo, committee secretary.
Good. Now we know everybody. So if we see or we read an informed source, don't worry, we've got two generals here. They will make work of it to put you as a priority case. And also to put you as a priority case, Honourable Flamingen. So if you want to go into priority, let's speak to General Sibia. General, I think, can we start with you? Because we're still waiting on ESCOM, on Department of Energy. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Once again, my name is General Sibia. Together with me, I'm with General Luke, who is responsible for visible policing and charged with combating cable theft from the visible policing side. The scope of my presentation will include the introduction of copper cable theft, the drivers of copper cable theft, the legislative framework and the challenges experienced, the national picture in terms of the crime levels and the successes or the achievements, and the police strategies looking in terms of the future plans. Throughout the industrialized world, stealing valuable metals has become a serious threat. Oh, can you assist me? Otherwise, I will... Apparently, I must. This one.
You see, I have a priority case. Somewhere you should have these slides.
No, we go and find her.
I'm just a policeman, Chair. Thank you. Throughout the industrialized world, stealing valuable metals has become a serious threat to the police, the business, public utilities, rail, road companies, and community at large. The export market is fast expanding, and South Africa has become one of the largest exporters of copper to the countries such as China and India. The consequence of copper cable theft negatively impact on victims financially, production, cleaning, profit margins, the telephone lines, electricity, and trains. We've all seen in Gauteng where the Gautrain is stuck and people can't even get to work. Some get fired and some get charged. Collaborative efforts to combat metal theft have occurred for several decades and is ongoing. In 1993, the Non-Ferrous Theft Combating Committee, NFTCC, was established to address the phenomenon. There is also a new one which was formed in 2009, and it is called the Non-Ferrous Metal Crime Combating Committee, and it is driven by a visible policing of the South African Police Services under the leadership of General Luke. The national and provincial investigations driven by subdivision, the Detective Service and Directorate for Priority Crime Investigations is also ongoing. Metal theft, in terms of its description, is theft of items for the value of their constituent metals. It usually increases when worldwide prices for scrap metal rises, as has happened dramatically due to rapid industrialization in India and China. The metals mostly commonly stolen are copper, aluminium, brass, and bronze. The offense carries possible imprisonment of 10 years, and this will contribute to the prevention and prosecution of copper cable-related crime. The defining characteristics of metal theft, besides being limited to items containing or made entirely from metal, is the motivation for the theft, whereas other items are generally stolen for their intrinsic value. Metal items are stolen for their more or less instinctive value as raw material or commodities. Items are ultimately scrapped or recycled to provide material for making new products. Now, we tried to look for the definition of copper cable theft. What do we mean when we say this is copper cable theft? Ellison and E. Howe contributor define copper cable theft as theft of copper or non-ferrous metal from a communications provider that causes damage to the facility or interferes with the company's ability to provide service. We also look at the value drivers, what causes people to really commit theft, what causes people to go out there and steal copper. And we look at the law enforcement agencies that have concluded that many metal theft are by drug addicts stealing metal in order to fund their addictions. These are your bread and butter type of people on the streets, where you find that, you know that if I can go cut that piece that long, I'll get so much for me to be able to survive, or maybe to be able to go buy drugs. It is believed that most of these drugs-related metal theft are caused by methamphetamine, which is a drug. Dek Nyaupe is a well-known drug in the locations, especially in Atresville and Soshanguve at that time. They call it Nyaupe, etc. This varies by the location where the metal is being stolen. Regardless of the reason, developing nations such as China, India, and South Korea are ever fueling the demand for it, because what happened is that we managed to find out that mostly this copper that has been stolen, this is where it's been taken to. Socio-economic conditions caused by unemployment and poverty contribute significantly to this phenomenon. And when we look at our legislative framework, the only law that is mostly applicable in terms of addressing copper cable theft, we're using the Second-Hand Goods Act of 2009, Act 1955. The South African Police Services administers Second-Hand Goods Act 2009, Act No. 6 of 2009. Although the Act is not yet fully put into operation, some sections were put into operations as from the 13th of December 2011 and the 16th of January 2012. Among these sections is Section 25, Subsection 4, which regulated the possession, acquisition, and disposal of cable consisting of controlled metal of which the covering has been banned. In other words, when you as a scrap metal owner and a person walks in saying, I'm selling this stuff for you, he needs to produce his ID so that you know who you're buying from. That's number one. Number two, it must still be covered so that we are able to identify whether it belongs to Telkom, whether it belongs to Eskom, but failure of which, then you also contribute in. And this is governed by Section 22, Subsection 1, that deals with false information and stolen goods and provides as follows. A dealer must immediately report the matter to a police official on duty at the police station in whose area the dealer carries on business. It further provides a foundation for cooperation and effective law enforcement. SAPS performance plan, this is in terms of SAPS performance plan of 2011 to 2012, prioritized the implementation of the Secondhand Goods Act to ensure compliance. There are other laws such as VAT, VET, and ITAC. I just want to say ITAC, it deals with the export and import permit. And the Road Traffic Act, Waste Management, Precious Metal, Consumer Protection, and Municipal, etc. Compliance monitoring will be done by associations. The Minister of Police may extend the powers under the Act to officials from other departments and parastatals in terms of Section 31. The Prevention of Organized Crime Act 1998, Act No. 121 of 1998, does not provide for classification of certain offenses as organized crime. However, all incidents of a serious nature that fall within the definition of the various offenses provided for in the Act are investigated under the Act and submitted to the prosecution authority for prosecution. Looking at the national picture, in all the reported incidents and arrests, starting from the 1st of January to up to the 31st of December 2011, as we can see, Honorable Chair, looking at the number of cases that were reported and the arrest made, in January, 4,929 cases were reported, but only 695 arrests were made. And we can all see that the performance there of the police really, compared to the number of cases reported, is really worrying. But then we then went back again and we looked at the challenges and said, but okay, what can we improve? And then in January, 5,225 were reported and only 909 arrests were made. In March, 5,942 were reported, 891 arrests were made. In April, 5,789 were reported and 779 arrests made. Now, as you can see, Honorable Chair, it is all in the range of 4,500, 6,000, and the number of arrests are all like between 1,000 and less. But there are also contributing factors there where you find that mostly we are dealing with one and the same group of offenders, because as a police, you also arrest, you do your job this side, but unfortunately or fortunately, the constitution of the country also allows people to be given bail and they're out of bail and they go back again. It's one and the same vicious cycle again. Looking at June, these are the figures, 6,345 cases reported, 912 arrests. July, 7,735 with 992 arrests. August, 6,770 cases reported, and at least it was one of those good successes where we arrested 1,142. And then in September, 6,608 cases reported, and we arrested almost 1,998. And in October, 6,160 cases reported. We arrested 1,034 people. In November, 5,803 cases reported. We arrested 910. In December, it's a little bit less because people now went home and some wanted to stay clean so that they don't get arrested in December. Mm-hmm. It was 4,787 and then we arrested 659. And also looking at the national picture, reported incidents and arrests in comparison between January 2011 and January 2012. When you compare the same period, we find that in January 2011, 4,929 cases were reported, and only 695 people arrested. In January, same month, but in 2012, 4,280 cases were reported, which is lesser than the previous year, and 711 people arrested. You can see that as a result of the strategies and the sector policing and all other measures put in place by the police, at least it went down when you compare the same period. Looking at the achievements of 2010-2011 financial year, copper cable theft related material to the amount of 37,522,947.95 have been seized for the period of 2010-2011. The DPCI non-ferrous metal desk became operational as from the 1st of September 2011 to focus on organized crime, and the following successes were achieved. Jointly with the role players such as the DPCI conducted operations, inspections in 43 identified scrap metal dealers. 6 scrap metal dealers were closed. 15 scrap metal dealers were fined for non-compliance. 15 scrap metal dealers were found to have licenses or submitted applications for renewal of licenses. 8 organized crime syndicates or groupings were identified and addressed, and 29 arrests were made and cases are still in court. We do have strategies in place, Honorable Chair, looking at our proactive approach. In 2009, the firearm, liquor and second-hand goods was established to deal with the proactive policing of all scrap metal dealers. Based on the DPCI threat and risk analysis, proactive deployment and operations are conducted at scrap metal dealers jointly with the Division Visible Policing, Criminal Record and Forensic Science Services and Crime Intelligence in conjunction with the affected role players. We do have sessions and meetings where we meet as with all the relevant role players to discuss the issues on the table and the way forward. The Directorate for Priority Crime Investigation selected non-ferrous metal as a national priority crime. Having selected the non-ferrous metal as a priority crime, with the intention that the main idea there is to focus on those who organize crime and benefit from it without being involved, looking at those what we call the high flyers now, rather than focusing on the bread and butter boys on the street running after the death to leave for the police. And as the GPCI, we're going to be focusing only now on those who organize crime and benefit from it behind the curtains without being involved. Those are the people that we want to focus on at the DPCI. National and provincial desk has been established in September 2011 to focus on non-ferrous metal in investigations to enhance coordination and investigation of organized crime syndicates. The SAP is presently in discussion with the Department of Justice to investigate the viability to make the minimum sentences under the Act 105 of 1997 applicable to serious cases of copper theft. We also have a multidisciplinary and collaborative approach in place. The Non-Ferrous Crime Combating Committee Forum has been established at national, provincial, cluster and station level and is constituted by the following role players: the South African Police Services, the DPCI, the Hawks, Division Visible Policing, BAC, Business Against Crime in South Africa, National Prosecuting Authority, other industries such as Eskom, Telkom, Transnet and Gautrain. The purpose of the forum is to discuss the nature and extent of the threat and develop mitigating strategies to address the copper-related crimes. A standard operating procedure has been developed to ensure information process flow, proper coordination, and joint execution of mandates. Further to the establishment of the national forum, provincial forum were also established. Further engagement with the Department of Trade and Industry, Department of Economic Development and International Trade Administration Commission, ITAC, to regulate and control the import and export of processes. Law enforcement agencies, in collaboration with the international trade administration authorities, should focus resources to check every container that leaves South Africa. We do have what we call City Deep in Gauteng. It's your dry port. It's just like this here, the port, the sea, or in Durban, in Eastern Cape, or here in Cape Town. We have many containers where you find that usually they will export, and then that's where they use these containers to export. As recommended by the Department of Justice and Constitutional Development, the South African Police Services, the DPCI, will engage to ensure that the training is provided to SAPS members and public prosecutors in order to enhance prevention, investigation, and prosecution of offenders relating to non-ferrous metal. Here the challenge is that sometimes you find that we don't form a good team or a formation, in a sense that you as a police official, you see this as crime and you attend to this because you sit with the relevant role players and you know the impact. But when it comes to court, the prosecutor look at the case and say, but this is 20 rand copper cable theft, and they usually call it de minimis non curat lex, which means the state does not concern itself with trivial matters. And usually they will just withdraw. And now the same guy that was arrested last night, when you said without electricity last night, you see him walking around again. Now these are the challenges also we're facing there. Now giving training to the investigators together with the prosecutors and sometimes even magistrate give us an opportunity to find ourselves reading from the same book, same paragraph, same sentence, agreeing in principle on what needs to be done. Looking at the future, from the DPCI, together with the relevant role players, we have what we call the champions, and each and every province must also establish such teams that will also make sure that they come up with operations that addresses copper cable theft. They need to identify the syndicates operating within their area. They need to make sure that they tighten the screws around the scrap metal dealers. The only challenge that at this stage we're still struggling with, Mr. Chair, is that between the bread and butter boys on the street up to the scrap dealer or scrap owner, that's where you can still find your case, where you can still arrest somebody. But once it has been with the scrap metal dealer and then it has been compressed somewhere, then it's taken now to a place where it's melted, now it becomes something there where you cannot even identify. It's now a legal thing. From there, it gets taken to a warehouse, and at the warehouse, now it's now something that is legal with a license. From there, your case is done, it's dead. It's exported now with all the legal papers, everything. So we need to be doing a lot of work now around the scrap owners and the warehouses. Along that, we should be able to fight the challenges that we experience there. But moreover, I want to mention that I think also our courts, if we were to join hands with our courts to make sure that they also look at this in serious light, because we do arrest people, but they get released as well. And these are the small challenges that we're still sitting with. With that, I've come to the end of my presentation, Mr. Chair. I don't know if General Luke would want to add anything on what I've said, sir.
Thank you, General. Honorable Chair, what I want to add is in connection with Section 22, subsection 1, whereby it's on page 4, the top slide, where it deals with where it says a dealer must immediately report if there's false information. Because what we've found out is that some of these people, as it has been said, that when people sell this copper to the dealers, they normally come with it bent. And when it's bent, it means they've removed the covering, whereby on the covering, that's where it can then say this copper belongs to Eskom, belongs to Telkom, and so on. So if that dealer buys it and it's bent, it doesn't have that covering, the dealer itself also will get into trouble, as it has, he has to have a clean copper still in the covering. He knows who he bought it from, so that tomorrow when we come to check for compliance, all those things are in place. Once that thing is not in place, then the dealer is arrested. Thanks, Connor.
Thank you very much, General Sibiya and General Luke. Honorable members, I think the Department of Justice is not here. We have invited them, because that is part of the reason that we, our invitation was to them. Because, as rightly as you say, General, that these guys disrupt the economy, they disrupt people's lives, and then they cause chaos. And then, just after a warning, they walk free, and they go and do the same thing over and over again. And that's why we've invited the Department of Justice also. But it seems to me they haven't pitched up. We will investigate why. Otherwise, we will get you guys to find out why they have not pitched up. But thank you very much for that input. Members, I'm opening up to you. Any questions? Honorable Fanningen, Honorable Abrams, and then Honorable Sinclair, in that order.
General, thank you very much. If we can tell you the sympathy that we have with the police and the fact that people run free out of court because it's considered minor offences, is not only with the copper theft, it's also with abalone, and it's also with rape cases. It's not serious enough. So we do have sympathy with you, and especially if we look at the rural areas, and I have a particular problem in the Carrero area, and I know Bobby answered that, huge cable theft problems. So we are aware of your problem, and we feel that justice should have been here this morning. There's a new act on the prevention of crime and something of corruption. I think it's Act 12 of 2004. Is that not giving you enough ammunition to close them up? And then the other question is DPCI. What is the common name or the code name? Is it Hawks or whatever?
The Hawks.
And then the cost of cable theft to business. Has anybody worked out what the cost of cable theft is to business and the influence on the GDP? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I just want to ask, on what level does the Metro Cops and the subs work together? Because most of the time when there's cable theft, the community would actually phone the Metro Cops, and just what level do you guys work together? Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you also to the generals and the police for their efforts of trying to really address this scourge that's really causing a lot of havoc in our country on many levels, you know, in terms of the economic difficulties, agriculture, mining, everywhere. But my concern this morning is the graph specifically, unfortunately, the page is not numbered, but the one that deals with the number of cases and the number of arrests. Now, it seems to me that there's very specific trends that you can pick up in this whole development. I don't believe, with due respect, General, for one moment, that those people that are perpetrators in those cases are every time new individuals involved in these crimes. There must be a repetitive nature in people that continuously go back. Now, we understand your frustrations about getting them, going through the judicial process and then being released on bail and so on. So the first question that I want to raise is, what is the repetitive nature of people being involved in this? You referred to gangs and drugs and whatever, but there must be cartels behind this, dealing with it. That is the big thing. If I can just for one moment elaborate on the issue about the illegal mining that we experienced, you know. There was very, very specific cartels involved, and once the police started to infiltrate and deal with those cartels, then certainly it went down. But of further concern to me is the number of cases registered and the arrest made. If you look at your statistics, General, you would see that the best is 17% almost, and the worst is 13% per month. For instance, in February, if you work it towards a percentage, it's 17%. And then the worst then was July, 13%. Now, from a policing perspective, that must raise very, very serious concern. It's one thing to say, yeah, there's other elements, especially this and that. But the primary responsibility of the police is first to get that perfect. And if we look at that statistics, on average, 13-14%. Then there's something seriously wrong with the police in terms of getting down to the perpetrator. Maybe Eskom would like to give us that figure, but I mean, for us it's very important to know what is the impact on the economy. Somewhere you quoted the figure about 23 million rand or whatever that was confiscated and so on. But what is the impact? Certainly you must in your own environment and also with your other role players establish what is that. Then largely, Chair, is the issue about the market. People will only involve themselves if they've got a market. And once again, back to the gold, the illegal gold saga. The police and we as responsible citizens must stop that market. And I know it's difficult. I hear the stories about your involvement in the ports and the containers and all those things and so on. But we must do more to stop that market. You know, it seems now these days, Chairperson, that these people are so desperate that they go into the townships and the more affluent townships and take every bit of copper. For instance, the numbering of their houses, you know, and so on and so on. Just to get, they lay their hand on, as the general correctly say, that 20 rand can maybe buy another bit of truck or whatever. But in the final instance, our responsibility as law-abiding citizens, we must stop that market. Which brings me to my last question, and that is, we can only stop it if we involve the communities and the policing community forums. That is, in the whole cycle of policing, that you would know better than I do, is the most important link, if you like. Thank you, Chair.
Hello, Fanninger.
Chairperson, the commercial crime unit is, from what I understand, is coming to an end at the end of March, and the Hawks is officially taking over, or I have it, that is what is going to happen in the Eastern Cape. Now there, in the commercial crime unit, they work with the prosecutor in every case. And at the moment there, they're terribly understaffed as far as the investigating officers are concerned. And I don't know the prosecutors and what balance they have. But I know they have a better success rate than what is shown here. We must also remember that if the valid cases of theft aren't recorded as they are here and giving us, and it gives us a true reflection, it may not be so encouraging when you look at the bottom line. But human nature is a funny thing, and I don't think we must be too harsh on the fact that the cases are so high and the arrests are so low. And I'm not saying that the arrests are good, but Otherwise, the cases are not reported properly and they're not recorded, because we often find that if there was a fight between a husband and a wife over a weekend with liquor involved, then the police would say to the couple, well, please come back on Monday, and by Monday, then the hate molest is all over. So you don't want that scenario. But are there incentives to encourage a higher success rate in the convictions here?
Generals, over to you.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The Act on Prevention of Corruption, it is applicable. And for the past year in Gauteng alone, we arrested more than 1,000 police officials, including or excluding the prosecutors or Metro Police. This clearly shows that the act is effective and is working, and we're also focusing on our own people internally. The figures, we gave the figures to say it is really affecting the economy of the country. And as you can see, 37.5 million is a lot. And we're talking about cases that were reported. Now, the commercial crime is not coming to an end. Remember, there was an Act of Parliament that says the DPCI needs to be independent from the Clenister judgment. Now, what is in the pipeline now is to say both organized crime and commercial crime, which form the DPCI, will remain under the detective services. Now, the DPCI needs to form an independent DPCI there. I'm not in a position or mandated to be reporting something like this. I'm just commenting on the comment, because this is not the final stage of it. But I'm just trying to say it is not true to say the commercial crime is coming to an end. It's not coming to an end. They're just going to remain within the detective environment. But officially, it will come from the official people who are better positioned to be reporting on something like that. It is true they are understaffed. But at this present moment, as the SAPS is going through the changes they are busy implementing, one cannot say they are really understaffed. It's just a question of balancing the resources and then placing people at the right places according to their ranks. Incentives. We do, each and every investigator is expected to have at least up to 4 informers. And we do pay informers. We do pay our police officials who work hard. We do even give them incentives in terms of monetary hours as well, or certificates signed by the National Commissioner, but they do get incentives. At what level Metro Cops and SAPS work together? We have forums where we're sitting together discussing policing matters. Both Metro Police and the Metro Police, they enforce the bylaws, and the police will investigate criminal cases. The object of the South African Police Services is to prevent and combat crime. In the event it cannot be combated or prevented, it must be seen to be investigated, and it must be investigated. And Metro Police are also part of the whole system. They enforce the bylaws, but we work together, even in teams. It is true that when you look at the value chain of how this crime is being committed, like I mentioned in the presentation earlier, it is not new people. It is one and the same group of people, but our constitution allows that when you are arrested, you are eligible, or you can apply for bail and be granted bail. Now, there are syndicates that are operating. If we can all remember or maybe agree that when such crimes are committed, we are all sleeping, we are at home, it's 2 o'clock in the early hours of the morning, at night. You know somewhere in the bush, somewhere that you cut your copper cable theft. You are sleeping at that time. You won't even realize that your gas is gone, your electricity is gone. Then they cut and they disappear. And thereafter, immediately somewhere, they will make sure that they remove the cover. As they remove the covering of the cable itself, not even Eskom nor Telkom can tell me that this is my copper cable. Now it's another challenge. They already removed it, they bent it there. We arrive in there, we arrest the person, we arrest the criminal, and in court they will just say, but whose copper cable is this? Eskom come look at it and say, so I think now of late they are able to, I don't know, because they do have numbers at some point, but they come at stage where you are unable to really identify whether it's Telkom or Eskom. But at this present moment, those are the small challenges that we are still sitting with. On the other hand, really the police alone, like our president said, together we can do more. The police alone, it will be practically impossible for them to be able to keep copper cable safe if they think they can do it alone. We do work with the communities. We do have sector policing in place. We do have policing forums all over the place that we're working with. They do bring information. We work with them. But the bottom line is, when there is copper cable theft and nobody can identify the companies that are involved, nor the other role players like your Eskom and your Telkom, they also have security companies that are actually working on copper cable theft, addressing or preventing copper cable theft to an extent that they even have alarms on the cable themselves. When you cut cable, you find that there is radio surveillance responding, and you find that there is Royal Security responding, those that respond now. But the challenges are, they too, to drive a van into the middle of the bush and try and see if you can trace the people, I mean, it's not always possible. But we do make arrests at the end of the day. It is indeed true that there are cartels behind this. Like I mentioned in my presentation, that mostly it goes to China and other places. They do have those people who organize this crime and benefit from it without being involved. I know that if I say to several scrap owners, scrap dealers, and say, this is your target, and I give you money, I will be where I'm expected to be. I will be at work, I will be in the casino, I'll be wherever where I'm expected to be. But the scrap owner down there, he knows what is expected of him in terms of his target. I'm not involved, I just gave him the target and I pay. And then he must just bring. And it doesn't even bring to me. He takes it somewhere where it gets done. I'm not involved. Now, that is why the DPCI is there, to say, what can be done to get to this man who is behind the curtain? Faceless one. But he's a beneficiary in this whole thing. The number of cases registered and arrested. It is true, when you look at the number of cases registered and the arrests made, that is why the DPCI now is embarking on projects. When you look at project, you begin to focus on syndicates that are operating to kill the market, number one, to kill the syndicates that are operating in the area. The moment you focus on the high flyers, on the syndicates, that is why the bread and butter people will also begin to suffer. Now, the DPCI is focusing mainly now on bigger picture, the project, where they will arrest the bigger people, rather than arresting or focusing on the bread and butter man on the street who is just getting 20 rand for the piece that he brought. Lastly, we do have relationship with our communities through our community policing forums. And every week or every day, we do sit in meetings with the community policing forums. We work together. We have the street patrollers. We have with the CPF on a daily basis. We have sector policing in place where each and every sector has got two vehicles running with the cell phones written of the van written on the side of the van, where you can phone immediately and say, hey, I see something happening, this is what is happening, 1, 2, 3, 4, and they respond immediately. So really the police are, they try to match the speed at which this crime is being committed, and through, or with the strategy as it's been put in place, I think it's improving on a daily basis. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, General. General Luke, anything you want to add?
Thanks, Chair. What I wanted to add is especially on the issue of educating the community. We have a communication strategy that talks to the community and educate them on the importance of this copper theft. But, you know, like the Honorable Member was saying, in the township, for argument's sake, stealing of copper is something that is still, you know, they take it very light, not looking at the repercussions. For argument's sake, if they steal copper cable that is connected to Baragwanath Hospital and electricity is cut, what happens at that time? Operations are stopped, a lot of things stop. And now the people in the township, they still don't take it serious. But we have a communication strategy that will go through our sector policing people and the community policing forum to inform them that the theft of copper cable is a very, very serious nature. As it has been said that with the minimum sentence now being 10 years, it just shows how serious it is. That's what I just wanted to do. Thanks.
Honourable Members, Honourable Abrams.
Thank you, sir. I just want to ask a follow-up question on the community informers. It's a nice word. They don't want to be called that. But what do we do to protect them? Because as much as the protection exists, you find some community members would want to give you the whole story. But then afterwards, they fear their life, because as soon as somebody finds out that they've been involved somewhere along the line within the police force, you find that there's a leak. How do we protect them to actually give us the information and later actually be rewarded for that and being anonymous but still know who it is? Thank you.
Honourable Fellinger, do you have a follow-up or question?
Thank you, Chairperson. It's very noble of the General to say that in SAPS they were amongst the police officers and the Metro Police and the prosecutors. In Gauteng, there were 1,000 arrests. But how many arrests were made of Eskom people and of Telkom people inside those firms and entities that have been arrested and prosecuted successfully?
Listen, Craig.
Yeah. I just want to ask from a police perspective, what is the solution to this?
excuse me, Honorable Maine. Okay. General, just you know, on the like I said, on the perspective we would have heard, like to have heard justice perspective on these issues. But were there discussions between police and Justice Department about or the prosecuting authority, NPA, National Prosecuting Authority, because it seems to me these cases in court are being treated the same way as a person that steals a loaf of bread from a shop, or a petty crime, which they call it, maybe a petty crime, or it's not worth the paperwork and the trial work and the hours of man hours and manpower set out to prosecute or to persecute such a person that is involved in cable theft and copper theft. In my constituency, for argument's sake, here on the Cape Flats, it's one of the worst crimes here. It's one of the worst things that you can get, because rightly, as you say, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, while people are sleeping. Now, these guys have got a way and a method of working, which they mark houses. They do all sorts of things, put the empty cooling tin in front of your door, or color-coded a cream soda tin, that is, the house is fine, a red tin, Coca-Cola tin, that is, there's occupants in the house, or stay away, or there's too much patrols, or anything, there's dogs, and, you know, now, it is of such a nature that these guys even outwit the police. They know for a fact that when is the shift changing, When is the sector shift changing? Where is the sector van? What time the sector van, or when will the sector van patrol an area? And they go to work. And when no one is at home, maybe during the day or during the night, they remove your copper. They remove the cables. They even remove the taps. Anything that is of value, they remove from your place. Honorable Van Mingen says even in the parliamentary villages. Now the point is, has there been discussions between police and NPA? Because if police are doing all the hard work in following up cases and arresting these people, and just to see that these people walk away, people are not blaming NPA out there. They say police didn't do their work. Because people out there in the constituencies and that are sometimes ignorant on how the justice system works. So they're blaming the police to say, no, the police are not doing this work properly. That's why these guys are walking again on the streets. They've been caught yesterday. They went to court this morning. The prosecutor says, no, case has been thrown out. The guy's 11 o'clock, he's on the streets again, roaming the streets of Mitchell's Plain, Lavendale and Steenberg. And then the people say, no. Sorry, the police did not do their work properly. So do you think, is there a way of maybe, and I want to join my colleagues, the public awareness campaign? At one stage it was on TV and everywhere, but it seems to me it has died down from the police side, this police side, this Isinyoka campaign and those campaigns. Are there any ways and means? We've got a big budget, trillions, we're talking about trillions now, and departments are talking about billions, not millions anymore. Are there any ways that these campaigns from the police side will be up and running again? Generals, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. I think maybe I should start from here, where it's still fresh. Honorable Chair, there are public awareness campaigns. Someone once said one day that I've seen people going out for a strategic planning session. Every year, companies, organizations, they go out for strategic planning sessions. But the more they go to strategic planning sessions, the more they stay the same. When you look at Eskom and Telkom, for years, before most of us here were even born, they've been sitting with the same situation, and they've been what has been discussed here have been discussed in many forums again, together with the prosecutors every day. What one can say is that fighting crime is an ongoing battle of the police. It is their responsibility. To say one can really completely stop crime is a myth. Organized crime syndicates are not only pervasive. They command a very strong financial background in such a way that they are able to even buy the best advocates, best legal defense, heavyweight legal defense, to be able to make sure that these people don't even, now talking real syndicate, they don't even land in jail. But the bottom line is, on a daily basis, the police are fighting this crime to an extent that, Chair, there are such discussions with justice. There are such discussions with the NPA. There are incidents or cases where even the prosecutors or advocates have been allocated to specific cases to work with the police to address those crimes. It is unfortunate that it is not each and every prosecutor who is trained to deal with this thing. Because, let's say for an example, I'm going to use Gauteng as an example. You will have an advocate who is responsible for illegal mining, or rather you will have an advocate charged with hijacked buildings. You will have an advocate charged with copper cable theft who work with the police on that. But it is not every case that gets taken to that particular advocate. When you are in Gauteng and then one of the places far from Johannesburg itself, you find that it will be one of the cases as normal. And then the fact that they also look at copper cable theft as one of those minor things that is actually wasting time. And you look at this case and you look at this one, you find that it's a
14-year-old or 15-year-old and say, but he's a minor as well, and this and that. And the challenges of also the fact that the prisons are full and with minor cases, and you find that now there's another challenge again. So, all right, if we have to keep this one of murder inside and this one of 20 rand copper cable theft, which one should I? And what? How much does it cost me as correctional services to maintain this one, give him food every day for copper of 20 rand that is low? So those are the other challenges that causes in the value chain, in the whole system, where you find that there are such frustrations and say, this one will have his own challenges in his own environment. Now, but the bottom line is there are challenges, there are discussions, and we have forums where we sit in together to address crime. In the same forum that is chaired by General Luke of Visible Policing, it's attended by the NPA, it's attended by Justice, it's attended by all the other role players as well in the industry, including Business Against Crime. They're also pulling in their muscles there in terms of even assisting financially to assist them to say what can be done to fight the scourge. And it is happening, Chair. Anti-corruption frontline. Honourable member asked, what can be done to protect the those that give information? Firstly, we do have the presidential hotline where people can just make a call and say, I want to remain anonymous, I'm giving this information. It's happening, it's busy, and it's yielding good results. People can phone crime stop, they do phone crime stop, 10111, and they do give information, sometimes anonymous. But most important, some work with the police and they want to be registered as informers so that they can get paid and when we are doing it and they are protected. So it's not always the case where you find that an informer's cover has been blown, because otherwise we'd be sitting with too many murder cases and assaults and all that. But people do get protected now. How many of Telkom and Eskom and the other question was, what is the solution to this? It's a difficult question to say what is the solution, because the solution is we have to work hard. All of us, we have to work together, like the president said, together we can do more. We do engage each other, we do engage one another in this industry, we meet, we talk, we strategize, we implement. After every meeting, we call people from different provinces. We discuss the strategy, we implement the strategy, we come back again, we evaluate the strategy and see if it works or not. And then where we need to adjust, we adjust. But on a daily basis, we do respond to the daily challenges of crime. I don't know if, Chair, I managed to really attempt to respond to this question that says, what is the solution to this? Because the solution to this is to arrest these people and put them behind bars, but we all need other organizations or departments like your Justice, your NPA. If the NPA is fighting with the police, fighting together from the same direction, and facing the defense together, then we are going to win. But if the NPA finds that, no, but this is petty according to me, I can't waste time here when I have a murder case to deal with the whole day, and let me deal with this one. This one will last for 30 minutes. I must just quickly withdraw this one, and then I am going to for this hearing now. Those are the daily challenges. And how many of Telkom we arrested on Eskom? We do. But I don't have the figures here to say I've arrested so many, because one does not anticipate to say you're going to get a question like this. But there are those that get arrested even internally by their own internal people. They do get arrested. And sometimes it doesn't even get to the point where it gets to the police, where a person is just being fired. But people are being arrested. General Luke.
I wanted to add on the question which is the solution to this stuff. On that, I think what we need to do also is a vigorous implementation of this Section 22.1, which says that if you buy without proper documentation for producing at the person that sells, must produce proper documentation and the cable must still be intact. If that is implemented furiously, every scrap metal dealer will then be strict in what he buys, and he would know from whom is he buying, which then leads to the question of the selling of metal without cable will then maybe decrease, because he would know that if this is found, because we also, as the police, we check these scrap metal dealers for compliance pertaining to this, as to you've got cable here, you say you've bought it, show us who you bought it from, and show us the whole cable, it must still be intact. So due to that, then I think with that Section 221, maybe it might help us in reducing the crime. Thanks.
Well, thank you, General. I think it is a massive task, and it is the responsibility of all of us. And if it needs be, we as the legislators need to tighten the laws, we'll just have to do that. If you need to tighten the laws for the APA, regulate, we will have to do that. If it can assist in combating that type of crime, we will have to do that, honorable members and people. But I think we can call on all South Africans to assist us, to assist the police, to assist the industry, and also to assist in combating this type of crime. And we should encourage our communities to go out there and report these incidents to the police as such. But, you know, the problem that is worrying, and it's good that I'm talking to the commander of Vispol, is that Vispol is not always as visible as it should be, General. You do get in stations where police have been alerted. I've had one case in my constituency where a person said she has alerted police of a lamp pole cable being stolen. Live cable. Lamp pole was still burning, but the cover was open. She flagged down the police there, and the police said, it's not my jurisdiction, I can't do anything about it. And he drove off. But I followed it up with the station commander, and they were quite helpful in that regard. And I think the member has been disciplined in that. But you know, it is a worrying factor of where Vispol just turn a blind eye where they see black smoke in a field coming, and it just drove past. Now, I would say, see that it is Vispol, they should go and investigate why there's some black smoke. What is happening there? Because it could be, and you know, these guys are burning most of their stuff in the field. They dig a hole, make the fire, put the copper, the wires, and the protective layers and all that on the fire, and just see smoke coming out there. And they don't do it openly like in an open field. They dug a hole because for your smoke to be controlled out there, you think the smoke will come out of a chimney. So controlled it is. So these guys have got, they invent ideas. They're quite inventive in terms of how they go about these things. But I think the responsibility lies in all of us. We need to, I think, one of our tasks here is Parliament as well. We need to conscientize our people that if we want to save our country, save the economy, also save lives, because it's a disruption. Not just on the economy, but on people's lives as well. You know, you get home and accidents are caused because cables are stolen and all that. But thank you very much to SAPS generals for taking the time off and to come and address us on that. We hope that we know that the work of a policeman is not easy, but we hope that it will become much easier if all of us just put hands together and try and combat these things. Honourable members, we have been joined by the DDG of Energy, Mr. Wumpy Abane. He has arrived. I've seen him. Oh, there you are. Very well. Welcome, DGG, and to all other people that has arrived. Justice has not arrived yet, eh? Not yet. Energy, will you take us through the presentation? I don't know, General, if it's up to you if you want to stay or if you can go and catch the criminals from that steals the copper table and General Luke and General Sevilla, we want to wish you all the best with your endeavors forward and to keep our country safe and to protect and to serve in all your work. Thank you very much. Just leave your business card with the secretary, please. Okay. Kumbi, DDG, I hope it was not copper theft. I hope you didn't fly the Albert Sky to get here. Oh, okay. But welcome, DDG. Thank you, generals. All the best. Honorable members, the Department of Public Enterprises will join us after lunch, as they are just with the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprises. So they will join us after lunch and do both presentations, copper cable theft and the other one on solar water heater. Is that fine, Honorable Sinclair?
Just on a technical point, I just want to remind you that if I look at the number of members here, we're not grating. But I know
we've got five provinces.
One,
in terms of the rules.
I know. But 1, 2, 3. So it's five.
Technical point overall.
Yeah, no. But then, Jay, I think maybe we must vote again and the opposition will take over the country.
We'll leave that for another day to vote on that for the opposition to take over. No, but we have five Honorable Sinclair and Honorable Maine has got two votes, one for the Youth League and one for the ANC, so...
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. I apologize for coming late. I'm going to take you through this presentation on cable theft, and I listened when the police gave their presentation. Maybe just to indicate before we start that we have had interaction with the South African Police Services around this problem, because we believe that there is very little that we could have done from our side to deal with the matter. So we're coming from the client side of things. Initially, we looked at the laws that we have within our jurisdiction, including the Electricity Regulation Act and so on. And one of the issues that had been considered was to see if we could not elevate the theft of copper, particularly in cable, to an economic crime. And we got to a point, Honorable Chair, where we have an agreement or an understanding with the South African Police Services that it is actually on the criminal justice system that the necessary amendments would be made. And I'm actually glad that they are on track to make those modifications to the law. Chair, maybe again to give some background here, that this is not a South African phenomenon. It is commonplace all over the world, particularly in those countries that could be classified as developing countries, but there are incidents in the UK that we take examples from. The British Transport Police have elevated this thing, to one of the highest priorities, ranking only second to terrorist threats because of the impact that it has when railway lines or, shall we say, trains are disrupted and so on. The question then is also, what is this cost on the economy? I think you asked the question, Chair, and it is very difficult to measure the cost on the economy. We, about 5 years ago, we calculated from an economic perspective that the cost of unserved energy in South Africa represented some 75 rand per unit. So in other words, it would be, I don't know, about 75 times what it would cost if you did not have that unit that was supposed to be there. And from there on, one can, you know, can estimate just how much impact this has on the economy, purely from the disruption of the power. In other words, direct disruption of the power. But insofar as the consequential impact on the economy, in other words, the fact that the trains will not be running and so on, it is very difficult to estimate that. But I think we take it as, you know, as a fact that it is something that is notionally very, very big. In 2010, estimates were that about 265 million rands of capital was lost in the replacement of the copper that was stolen. In other words, those incidents, if you had to quantify them and then replace the cable that was stolen, however long it took to replace the cable, just the direct cost was 265 million rand. But we think that it's about 5 billion rand in terms of those incidents that emanated from the copper that was stolen from electricity. And this creates additional problems for the economy. I mean, amongst which is the issue of investor, you know, perception, negative investor perception. We have heard about disruptions to the power, communication and transport sectors, but there's also damage to other infrastructure. Sometimes when the copper is stolen, or when cable generally is stolen, other infrastructure is damaged. I think about, again, 5 or 10 years ago, Spornet then introduced an alloy that tried to discourage people from stealing copper. So it was copper mixed with some other element to make it not as attractive. But because of ignorance, it got stolen and other infrastructure was damaged. And, you know, the damage to that infrastructure, you know, causes huge replacement costs that has to be catered for, apart from the direct or the indirect disruptions to the, you know, the activity or the production that relates to that electricity grid. And then there's also the issue about the cost of security itself. And we heard from the police about how some of these cable systems are alarmed and there are, you know, emergency response teams, armed guards and so on to make sure that they protect the infrastructure. That is a burden on the supply of or on the business that have to provide that infrastructure for them. We also have an issue around safety, and here we're not talking about, you know, safety from deliberate electrocution, because sometimes what happens is that the so-called earth point, in other words, the earthing of an electrical system, is very critical to protect humans. And when this is stolen, because it's copper, you don't necessarily realize that it's been stolen, and it harms both humans and livestock. I'm not going to repeat the telecoms and the railway issues, but I think the big example here is Gautrain. I think last year there were about 4 disruptions to Gautrain, and one was unrelated to, you know, sorry, only one was unrelated to copper theft. Most of them were mainly around copper. And, you know, you can imagine just the consequences of such a critical logistical infrastructure in the country. So we then, as I indicated, got to a point where we wanted to, you know, to engage South African police services and the South African Police Department in order to ensure that there is, you know, correlation in our approaches, where this is not just the theft of 50 rand, as the general put it, but it's the fact that you stole 50 rand worth of copper, but the consequences are a lot more severe. And to also try and get to an understanding of the syndicates that were behind this. And I think from this same premise, we got to that understanding that, in fact, certain amendments to the law had to be made under the jurisdiction of the South African Police Services. But then we also had to engage in a manner that addresses the problem across the entire value chain. Because, you know, as I think as the police indicated, you know, there is somebody or there are people high up who are behind, and this, and if you don't address the value chain, you might not be able to understand how, for example, we cited those countries, not out of disrespect, but it's the examples where we know that this kind of export trade is taking place. Then there's the issue around, you know, the prices relating to these non-ferrous metals. But incidentally, it's not just copper that gets stolen. There's also other metal that tends to, you know, fall into the category of scrap metal. But non-ferrous table generally is very attractive as a commodity, and it can be, you know, traded in a manner that draws more and more people into this illegal activity. And then how do we, I think the question was asked by the chair, how do we try and mitigate this? And this is mainly from our perspective, not from the police or the justice perspective, is that, yes, there has to be some wedge between the increasing prices of the metals and the cable theft opportunity. So basically what we're saying is that irrespective that we do not control the cables or the metal prices, you know, there needs to be a disconnect between that and the opportunity to steal cable. And this requires certain interventions by Eskom, the telecoms entities, and the rail companies. It also requires collaboration between with the lawmakers, scrap metal dealers, and law enforcement. And I think we've heard today, Chair, about what will now be the situation relative to scrap metal dealers, the requirements in terms of the new approach. And we've also heard how the police themselves are preparing themselves or gearing themselves with the collaboration of the communities to deal with this matter. But then the big question still remains, you know, the level of sophistication that is required by the lawmakers, not necessarily the lawmakers themselves or alone, but the lawmakers and the Justice Department in terms of making sure that there is a, you know, coherent approach to dealing with this issue. And then we cite electric communication and rail utilities as well, because perhaps there are technological innovations that could be considered in order to deal with this. You know, by and large, it is the copper that gets stolen and not the aluminium. And it is by and large, you know, possible to, you know, avoid using copper and to use other alternatives in order to ensure that it does not become, you know, a weak link in the chain, so to speak. The issue around legislation itself, so we're watching very closely what the amendment to that law will do, but we also thought that I don't purport to speak as a lawyer, not a lawyer at all, Chair, but the Criminal Procedures Act was one of those that we had considered, because that is where one is able to impose the necessary sanction relative to specific crimes that had been identified. So as opposed to it being a simple, you know, 50 rand theft and you get bail immediately, you know, one needs to go further than that and ensure that the law is amended to ensure that cable theft is regarded in the serious light that it is, well, it currently is. Now, Chair, we're not throwing any you know, any rocks in the sea, but we believe that there are some weaknesses in our diesel system relating to the impact, and we saw some of the stats that affect this problem. In the past, there were these problems with second-hand scrap metal dealers, but I believe there is an effort to try and deal or to address the problem. But customs as well, you know, where material leaves the country. But just by way of example, you know, certain material cannot leave the country without it being flagged. You know, a good example would be a nuclear material that, you know, everybody becomes aware that this is a sort of controlled substance, and therefore the inspection around it is a lot more vigilant than everything else. And I think it is one of those things that perhaps we need to look at in terms of making sure that copper does not leave the country in certain forms, you know, that cannot be balanced back to the source. I'm not going to repeat the one about the Secondhand Goods Act. We have some collaboration with the South African Police Services in terms of this, and I think the General has covered it in some detail. The Special Crime Prevention Unit is what we had proposed, and again, without being patronizing, we're not the police, but we're saying that it obviously requires some focus within the criminal justice system. Incidentally, Chair, one of the things that we're doing on this point is that we're trying to disaggregate incidents of power disruptions that are caused by, shall we say, non-copper theft problems in a way that would indicate the extent to which this is actually the biggest problem that we have to face over and above making sure that there is supply of electricity. Unfortunately, it's only recently that we started collecting those statistics, and we might be able to get some correlation between how this you know, poses a power supply threat. And then the issue around community awareness, I'm going to deal with the one about you know, customs and so on. I've dealt with that already. Community awareness is very critical. And community awareness is not only when there is theft that the police are alerted, but it's also a proactive, you know, shall we say, vigilance that makes sure that communities become the eyes and ears, you know, for society in relation to cable theft prevention. And I think maybe Eskom could speak to this as well, because I know they have a very, directed interventions that deal with Izinyoka and, you know, theft of electricity and so on. And that's the end of my presentation there.
You have brought your rent-a-crowd audience along. Audience. Well done. Okay. Honorable members, the gentleman that has just arrived from Transit. Okay, now you can, if there is any more empty seats this side, you can take. Honourable members, question time. Hello, Zaminga, nothing?
No.
Okay. Hello, wasn't clear? Are you also waiting for Honourable Zaminga to finish?
I just want to make a remark. You know, one can see that the Department of Energy is really engaging this whole
the whole issue, because it's a very, very serious issue, as we know. But I'm very concerned that the Department of Justice is not here today, because once again it seems that we're preaching to the converted. It seems to me that the solution, and that's what I believe we need to get to, lies in the whole issue about how do you address these things once the perpetrator has been apprehended. And I don't know, maybe through you, the committee secretary can give us an indication if Department of Justice indicated that they would come. Because if not, then we must make a plan to see them. Because they are, at the moment, the missing link in this whole effort to try and establish a possible way forward and a solution. Linked to that is, if for instance, we want to go that the route that Mustafani is indicated, to say that there must be an embargo on specific product, like for instance your copper, how would one engage that? Would it be through Department of Trade and Industry by special regulations or what? Because if I can reiterate my previous viewpoint, we must stop the market. That is reality. So that's the question to Mustafani.
Just in response to the Department of Justice, the response that we got is that they didn't see it necessary for them to attend because it's got nothing to do with their line function. So, but we will engage with the Director General and the Ministry about that. Honourable Verlingen?
Thank you very much. DDG, you said we must change the legislation. But then the comments are a bit vague because you don't say exactly where the legislation must be changed. And then you say there's a weakness in the legal system, but you do not pinpoint. So the blame goes from one to another, except we don't know how and where to look for it. So if we can be specific, then it helps a lot. And then I forgot to ask the police services, what part of the Second Hand Act has not come into full effect yet? Because the last phrase he used was the 16th of January or something to that effect. And then we were here last week talking about the maintenance of distribution lines and the costs and the fact that it deteriorates by 2.5 billion a year. Does the copper theft have anything to do with it? And are we serious about replacing it with aluminium and so on? And is that the high cost or where are we?
DDG?
Thank you, Chair. The issue about the legislation is that there is a legislative framework that could be used to tighten, you know, the manner in which we deal with this particular problem. And we engaged with the South African Police Service, and it was indicated that the Second Hand Goods Act is the right point. And that Second Hand Goods Act, as we had engaged with them at that time, which was like maybe the second half of last year, was that it had not, the certain provisions that had not yet come into effect. And that's why I indicated that I'm glad that they made reference to it today, in the sense that it is now, you know, a mechanism that is being given effect to it. And under the Second Hand Goods Act, I believe that there were possibilities around the promulgation of regulations, those regulations which would specifically be able to deal with, for example, the concern that scrap metal dealers are able to receive, you know, copper in a different format, and then they're able to, you know, shall we say, trade with impunity, irrespective that this could have been stolen and so on. So
they have indicated to the police today that there is an opportunity there where one can demand that, you know, this permitting and so on, that it's being proposed around there. So it is that kind of, you know, revamp to the legislation / justice, you know, system that we are talking about. We're not saying that we have all the answers, but we're seeing that the problem is that, first of all, it gets stolen, but I think, as Honorable Sinclair indicated, it's also the market side that we have to deal with. That once it has been stolen, you know, it goes into the scrap metal industry, and then, you know, the whole thing sustains itself like that. So if you stop it there, you might be able to, you know, to if you stop it there through legislation and regulation and so on, you might be able to deal with it, insofar as it relates to it as a second-hand good in the hands of scrap metal dealers. But there's the other aspect as well, and unfortunately, Jay, I'm no expert on this, but when it comes to, you know, customs, right, there are laws around customs, right, and the example that we're giving here is that when certain goods enter or leave the country, they are designated in a particular way, you know, where one is able to, you know, to ensure that as designated or controlled goods and substances, one can, you know, demand that certain balances could be, you know, required. In other words, that the source must be able to be identified so that it's cleared, rather than it just being exported like that. So that's the suite of you know, mechanisms that we think could be given effect to, mainly through the justice system. But I think, without putting anybody into trouble, Honorable Chair, I think also customs, which is a DTI issue, that perhaps there could be some comments from them around that. And then the question around whether the electricity distribution industry problems have any, you know, linkage with this, and it certainly is a big concern. Most of the electrification, fortunately, involves aluminium more than copper, so it is in relation mainly to the old infrastructure, where there are still, you know, networks that are built on copper. But I must, maybe Eskom can give us some more detail on this. But we are aware of circumstances where, you know, cable theft is indicated as being the problem for supply disruptions, particularly, you know, in, I think about 2 years ago, in most of the reported incidents by City Power, in particular, it had been indicated that, you know, cable is the problem when there's been disruptions in their networks. And I think that covers the... I hope I've answered all the questions, Chair. Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you, DDG. Do there is any more questions, Honourable Members? The DDG is here. Hold there with us. Am I right, DDG? Yeah. He's here all day. And we can just engage him then afterwards. Thank you very much, DDG, for that, for the briefing and input. Justice has still not arrived. Eskom? I think you can take up membership of this committee now. Thank you for coming.
There's another one, and then there's one by Eskom now,
and then after lunch, about 5 to 4, there's another one. Was it an oversight or is it a different presentation?
If you look on top of the agenda, that was not an oversight. Two different presentations. Just look on top of your agenda. The first one is on the copper theft, cable theft.
Oh, sorry.
The second one is on the solar water heaters, the rollout.
I'm sorry, Tim. Because I... I just want to submit my apology for the afternoon session at about 4. The solar water, I've got warm water at home, so I'll go there.
But the courts are closed for corporate. Courts are turning at up past 3.
Yeah, but they open again tomorrow morning, so we must be there.
Well, we see that we haven't got most of the like justice is not here, and we'll see how far we go, members. We might include, if we are done with the morning session before lunch, we might start immediately with the solar water rollout of solar water heaters then before lunch, and just proceed with it after lunch, and we could finish earlier. I know some of you would love to go spend more time at the hotel and invest more in the Cape wines and in the Cape culinary, so we're not going to stop you from doing that. CEO?
Honorable Chair, I wish I were the CEO, but I certainly am not the CEO of Eskom. I'm the Group Executive for Distribution. Chair, just first things first, I must apologize for coming in late. I actually felt very embarrassed when I was told that the meeting starts at 9, when I've got something that says at 10 o'clock. And, you know, as it goes with Murphy's Law, if anything is going to go wrong, it's going to go wrong. So today was very bad for me. I got a message to say that the presentation hasn't come through to the members and a whole host of things, Chair, which I don't want to bore you with, but I do just want to sincerely apologize for being late and also for some miscommunication to the members as well. It's not out of disrespect. I think it was just terrible communication, and we'll make sure that it doesn't happen again. It always kind of unsettles one, and you come in and you're already worried about the presentation and all that, but I will do my best. Chair, having said that, my presentation really is just going to focus. I think I just want to give a sense of the picture of what we are experiencing from an Eskom point of view, and I will also attempt to deal with some of the questions that have been already asked. I do have a very long presentation, but I will try and also just contain it in terms of the time. You know, if you look at the next slide, which I have got on slide 3, it's basically showing you our value chain or our electricity supply chain, and really it's just an indication for us to have a sense of what parts of this supply chain could be impacted, and really it is from generation right through to the residential environment where we experience the theft of conductors. Now, I've also deliberately spoken about the infrastructure theft because, you know, when you only contain it around your conductors, then you lose sight of the rest of the value chain in terms of how it can actually be impacted. And specifically, I've also looked at distribution. If you look at that little blocky that's got the asset base in it, you can see why I would like to focus on distribution, because it's got a major footprint, and I think this is where also your customers also feel the impact of, or the greatest impact, I should say, of the theft of the infrastructure. So you can see that in terms of the footprint, it's massive for our 4.7 million customers, and therefore the impact would really be a lot. Now, in terms of the problem statement, I think a lot has been said already about the theft of non-ferrous metals. But specifically, I would like to draw your attention to the last bullet, which talks about the number of incidents. And just in the between April and December 2011, we had 1,591 conductor theft incidents. And the value to that, we've calculated it to be 22 million. And I'm just talking direct costs.
Because what I'm also hearing the members ask is how much more, I mean, how much does this really cost us? Now, in terms of the direct costs, in other words, the material that has been stolen, it is that 22 million, just over 22, and about 2.5 million of that has been recovered in the period that I'm talking about. But again, we have to remember that the costs, for example, to manage the problem, I am not including here, and the figure that I can recall from 2009 or 2010 is that we spent about 300 million rand just to manage the problem. So in other words, your security, the campaigns that we have been talking about, the unserved energy that OMP has talked about, you know, it's something that we would also have to quantify. So you can see that it's just the tip of the iceberg, the number that I'm sharing there. Honorable members, just for you to orientate yourself in terms of that map, I would like you to think about when I'm talking about the regions, because in terms of how we have aligned or structured ourselves in distribution in the past, we are looking at the six regions, and I just wanted you to have a sense of when I talk about the northern region, that you know that is the region that's written up there, the old north and old northern east. So it's the top part of the, so when I say northern region, that's what I'm referring to. When I'm talking about western region, I'm talking about the old western, which would be the purple on the left hand side, you know, just for orientation in reference to the graph that I'm going to show you next. Now, I've also looked at transmission, because, you know, with the transmission lines, we really have a major challenge there, where we find that the structures, our structures are being tampered with as well. Now, you can imagine those very tall structures, I think about 22 meters or so, that may, you know, if they are unbalanced, you know, the conductors will actually fall down, and that would cause a major challenge. So from a transmission point of view, you can see that the biggest challenge is really around the set of the pylons. In distribution, we experience that as well, because we also have our own pylons. And as I said, we've got a very large footprint across the country. So basically the slide, really the key message in that slide and the next one, is that the biggest challenge in distribution and transmission combined would be the theft of the pylons. And the next slide basically shares how much that cost, the monetary value of those incidents. Now, from a distribution point of view, again, coming back to the point that we have a massive footprint, you can see that over the last 7 years, there has been a decline or reduction in terms of the incidents that we have experienced. So, you know, I can say tongue-in-cheek that our annual strategic plans are actually paying off. The colleague from the SEP did mention that every year we look at, you know, we have all these strategic plans and they don't seem to be yielding results, but that graph actually shows that they are yielding the results. We haven't eradicated the problem, you know, which is really the desired state, but we have reduced the number of incidents. What I find very interesting, though, is that around 2010, when we were mobilizing or, you know, getting together as a country to deliver on 2010, there was so much collaboration, you know, across all different parties. You know, the municipalities, we were working together with the municipalities. We worked together with Transnet. We worked together with a whole lot, you know, with the telecoms, a number of stakeholders to really try and address or make sure that we deliver very well on the 2010 World Cup. And those are some of the connections that we made during that time, and we made sure that we deliver. And in fact, you'll see that in 2010, our incidents reduced, you know, during that time, also because of that amount of effort. For example, we would share things like, you know, the security during line patrols. You know, if Transnet would be doing line patrols in an area where we've got lines, we actually would ask them to do the same for us, and vice versa. So there was really a lot of collaboration there. Now, if you just reflect on the map that I showed you, you can also see again here that, you know, this is really just to show you the incidents in 2011-12 financial year to up to December. So you can see the regions that are really sticking out. Your northwest region is sticking out like a sore thumb. We didn't include central region because the number of incidents there, as you will see in the next slide, they are so high. You know, it isn't a problematic area for us. This is basically your Gauteng province primarily, and you will see that although we have contained the incidents, or you can see a reduction, but it isn't an area where we've got the greatest challenge in terms of the number of incidents. The next slide basically shows you the length of line per region, the length of line that has been stolen in that same period that we are talking about. And then the next one also talks to the EDEC. EDEC is basically the conductor that we use for getting electricity to the houses, the electrification type of conductor. Now, what is interesting with that one is that we find that it is stolen primarily for doing illegal connections. So this is now another element. It's not stolen to be sold. It's actually stolen to be reused for illegal connections. The other element that we have, you know, we monitor regularly is the theft of our transformers. You know, obviously our transformers have copper in them. So this is also another area, and hence I say, you know, it's important to look at the total infrastructure theft rather than just focusing on the theft of conductor only. You know, the impact on the business, really, it's, I think we've already spoken about that. Perhaps the important one that I will just highlight here is, you know, safety and security. Security of supply becomes a challenge. You disrupt a number of businesses, you disrupt people's lives, you cannot get on with business. We compromise on security of supply. And of course, when there isn't electricity, people cannot do their work. If you have a business in your house, you cannot continue with your business as a result of that. And in some cases, we also have, you know, people who will come and claim for damages from Eskom, and they will say to you, we told you that there was a cable theft in a particular place. What have you done about it? And, you know, it becomes a recurring problem. And we also find that from a financial point of view, of course, we would have to look at our insurance insurance claims, because they actually go up as it becomes a spiraling effect. In terms of the challenges, we've already heard that it's actually syndicates that are doing this. In fact, one of the days last week, I was at one of our sites, you know, just to do a site inspection, and it's a construction site with substations. It's a construction site where a substation is being built for electrification. But what is interesting there also is that in that substation, we're going to lay the copper that Mr. Apane spoke about earlier. And one of the things that we have to do in that area is to make sure that there is security, you know, around. And when I asked the people on site, the site supervisor, if we do have a person on site, a security on site, they said, yes, we do have security on site and they're armed, but when the thieves come, you know, they come in, they're armed. And we've actually had quite a number of these incidents where our own security you know, get shot at and they get injured or killed as a result of. So it is a lot of money. Some of it you can quantify, other you cannot. You cannot quantify. I've already spoken to the illegal connections in terms of stealing of EDEC, and you know, the lack of awareness also from the communities. And you will see in a moment in terms of the strategies that I'm going to talk to, and what are we doing about that. But what I find with the communities is that in some cases they are very scared to, you know, to say that we have seen the criminals, you know, in case of being victimized and that sort of thing. So it is certainly a challenge. But from how we are dealing with it, you know, there are two critical things. And I would say that the first is looking at our own internal strategies. We do have committees internally which basically look at you know, our network across the regions to look at where our problem areas are. And of course, we look at how do we deal with this problem? How do we, you know, running the campaigns in terms of the awareness. And what we do is to look at the awareness programs and we integrate them into our public safety initiatives, which is also a big drive for us from a safety point of view. But also, we look at the hotspots. You know, which are the areas that are really prone to this crime, and how can we then mobilize from an internal point of view our own resources to make sure that we deal with the problem. And then externally, of course, I think this has already been mentioned, that there are a number of other committees that are happening. Membership, for example, of the Non-Ferrous Crime Combating Committee. We participate in those structures. We participate in structures, organized crime units through SEPs, and also with other state-owned companies. In fact, 2 years ago, I recall, we had a conference with Transnet specifically to look at all the challenges and how we can deal with the challenges as a state-owned companies fraternity. So there are a lot of things that we are doing as well to make sure that from our point of view, we are dealing with the problem. Because some of the challenges, interestingly enough, we find that they can be solved if I look at electrification as an example, I can recall that at this workshop we had with Transnet, Transnet mentioned that they have a challenge where people are stealing a lot of their batteries so that they can go and electrify their houses. And we realize that from our point of view, if we speeded up on the electrification of those particular areas, probably Transnet wouldn't have the problem of batteries being stolen. So those are some of the areas that we identify. And if I can just run quickly through other strategies that we have, I think the previous speaker talked about the technology that we use from an ESCOM point of view, where we implement alarms and monitoring systems, where we actually have a system where if we see that our conductor has been cut off, it will actually ring an alarm at our control center so that we can mobilize and do something about that and deal with that situation. And the other one, of course, is really looking at intelligence, and this is really networking with other bodies across the country that also have the same challenge so that we can understand where the hotspots are. What I also found interesting with Transnet when I looked at their presentation a couple of years ago is that when we looked at our hotspots in terms of where we are experiencing the most challenges, we actually found that there is alignment in terms of that. So we can then in those areas collaborate and make sure that our efforts are focused. Physical security I've already spoken about. We spend a lot of money in terms of getting physical security because you can imagine we have a number of substations, particularly in distribution. We've got over 300 substations. So in that case, in fact, it's about 5,000 substations, I'm underestimating here. So you can imagine that those then become the targets or potential targets for crime. So in cases like those, we need to collaborate with other companies that also are prone to this crime and also talk to the communities in that environment to make sure that we can work together in solving the problem. So it really is a point of combined efforts. I'm not going to spend too much time on the legislation because I think this part is really about, the other part of the strategy is really the enforcement of the law. So the law enforcement agencies also have to come to the party in terms of supporting us with the arrests and making sure that when the people are caught, there is something substantial that happens to them so that we can stop experiencing this to this large extent. And then awareness, of course, I've already spoken to the point that, we need to inform and educate people. But I think most of all for us is to really enlist all South Africans to be aware and alert and to be part of solving the problem instead of being part of the crime. And all the opportunities that we have to go and talk about this problem, we make sure that we exploit those opportunities. The other one, of course, is, the combination of all of these strategies using your technology, your intelligence, and your physical security. And you've got to, in some cases, make sure that you use all of them, combined, instead of just having, separate interventions or strategies employed in different places. So this is really how we are dealing with making sure that from our perspective we deal with the crime decisively. I've already spoken to quite a lot of, I think a lot of my slides are probably repeating the message, you know, in terms of what we are doing. But really, I think for me, the main point, Chair and members of the committee, is that there is something that we are doing, which is comprised of our own internal initiatives. We also have external initiatives. And of course, we also have, you know, the technology that we are using to make sure that we can deal with the problem going forward. And Chair, just the last thing I want to show really is what your, you know, what is this, if you look at it pictorially, what does this problem look like? You can see the scrap yards there, you can see a lot of conductor there. Here's our copper, our earth straps. You can see, you know, the scrap dealer yard, you know what it looks like, and it really is a lot of material, it is a lot of money, and it really causes a lot of disruption to the economy and also to, you know, the public at large. Honorable Chairman, this is the end of my presentation, just to give you a brief overview of what challenges we face at Eskom and how we are dealing with them. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Nova. You know, when in Cape Town, if you have the surname Nova, then you think of one gentleman who's really out of order sometimes. But we all love him. We all love him. My good friend Trevor Nova. Is your cousin? Okay. Now you must send our love and regards to him. He's one of our famous up-and-coming stars. Honorable Sinclair, have you heard him already? No, we must see that it is the cousin of the group executive. She must arrange for us what she has to go and see. Because he thinks that he's from Colesberg. So. But no, thank you very much, ma'am. Let's get back to the business that we are here for. Honourable members, any questions? Seems to me you have nothing. Let's go for tea, and when we come back, maybe you have collected some questions. And Madam Nova, you'll still be in the hot seat after tea. But let's just break for tea. Can we come back? It is now, 22? Can we come back at 10 to 12? Honourable Verlingen? Can we come back at 10 to 12? Thank you. We'll come back at 10 to 12, and then we'll just take the questions for Eskom, and we'll start then with Transnet. Thank you. Tea's outside.
I keep throwing your chairs away. That is funny.
Thank you. Andiyazi kutanga pendu la mwa. Putana wada ayo.
Oh, no. Ladies and gentlemen, honorable members, Eskom is still in the hot seat. Or honorable members, have you taken Eskom off the hot seat? Honorable Verlingen, have you taken Eskom off the hot seat? Okay. Ma'am, you see, you are visiting this committee so frequently that they start to feel sorry for you now. Okay, members, we now proceed to Transnet. I see they are ready. Please help yourself to the tea and coffee that's outside. Otherwise, I'll ask Business Day to just report that you are afraid, and we will put that on your expenses as wasteful and fruitful expenditure. Eskom, Transnet, and who else must pay for that? SALGA and Department of Energy must pay for those refreshments that's still outside. So help yourself to some refreshments there so that it doesn't go to waste. Thanks. Transnet, sir.
Chairperson, honorable members of the committee, I think it will be important that before I start, let me introduce my team. On my left-hand side, I've got Brigadier General retired, Jonas Wagau. He's now heading our security at TFR, Transnet Freight Rail. I think most of the questions in this presentation, generally, it affects TFR as the biggest business in Transnet. And together I also have Mr. Martin Sekapela. Martin is in the office of the GCE, Mr. Brian Molefe, as our executive manager in the GCE's office. Myself, I'm also a retired Major General, Rodney Tuka. I'm presently the General Manager of Responsible for Security Management in Transnet. So I think the team that is here will be able to answer questions, especially in terms of cable theft, because this is generally the team that deals with issues of cable theft. Chairperson, I think it is a fact that theft and vandalism has a dramatic effect on Transnet as a business, on Transnet operations, its customers and the business that we are doing. And that even though we have implemented a number of initiatives in the past, but you can see that cable theft increases in all the, especially in the last 3 years, you will see the stats that it will show that it has been increasing. And this generally because of the cancellation of slots, the trains that have been cancelled whatsoever, it has got a direct impact on the economy of the country. And it affects also strategic commodities like your iron ore exports, your fast-moving consumer goods, your coal exports, your local coal supplying, especially to Eskom power stations, and your land to the Rainwater Board. This in itself, I think, it does do a harm to our economy. The high incidence of cable theft has, in most cases, rendered our railway lines unreliable. Because of cable theft, customers, you know, cable theft in itself, I think it had a reputational risk, especially in terms of our customers, that because of cable theft, because trains are not arriving in time, that in itself has made railway unreliable. And this generally impacts on the national budget. In terms of Transnet pipelines, cable theft has minimal operational disruptions, but it has major consequential damages. And the majority of cable stolen are connected to the cathodic protection system, which protects the pipeline from corroding generally. And this in itself, it creates a problem. If you look at the slide before you, it shows that as from 2008 to 2009, as Transnet, I don't want to talk about Eskom and others, but as Transnet, we have had about 1,432 incidents of cable theft. This resulting in a loss of about 12 million and being replaced by 30 million. I'd like to explain the issue of loss and replacement because they differ in terms of if you look at your losses, generally 12 million, but you replace that for about 30 million. What happens is that you will find that the cable, when it was bought 5 years back, this is what it cost. Then because you're fixing it after some years, then this is what it costs you to replace it. And if you look at 2009-2010, the incidents were 2014, which there was an increase in terms of incidents, and 2010-2011, there's about 2,091. But if you look at this year, 2011-2012, year-to-date, we're talking about 1,380 incidents. This in itself is showing us that definitely this year we will have a dramatic decrease in terms of our copper cable incidents. But we will explain to the committee what is it that we're doing that shows a decrease in terms of copper, the incidence of copper. Well, the slide before you is just a graph that shows the same thing. That's in terms of your cable theft, there was an increase, but now you can see there's a decrease in terms of cable theft. And in terms of the rent value as well, I think there's a decrease in terms of the rent value. I think this year only, up to December, we're talking about the decrease of, I think, we're,
we're looking at about 21 million that we have already decreased in terms of our copper cable incidents. Preventative interventions, this is what we are doing in Transnet. We are bringing in an in-house security to protect our key installations. Generally, if you look at other countries, especially in Europe, they have what they call critical installations or critical infrastructure. So as Transnet, what we have done in terms of our security, we have a hybrid model that we are looking at. In terms of that hybrid model, critical infrastructure will be taken care by our own in-house personnel. Because we have realized that by bringing in your own in-house, the first thing that you have is you have a sense of loyalty from your own employees. And the other thing, the issue of command and control becomes easy. Unlike if you use like your external contractors, because you give them a specific contract, maybe for a period of 2 years, they are only committed for the first year. For the second year, they are no longer committed because they know that they'll be going. So that in itself, it creates a problem in terms of loyalty. But if you bring your own people to get their own installations, one thing that you might enjoy is issues of loyalty. So we are building on an in-house capability within Transnet to guard what we term critical installation. So your copper cables, your SCADA systems, and all these other systems, those are the ones, especially the ones that if disrupted, they will cause a disruption in terms of the business. Those are the ones that we term critical installations. So that is what we are looking at. We have established a school of security. I think the first group of 200 in-house security will be trained by the school. We should deploy them by the 1st of July this year. We have joint operations together with the police. What we have done is that, firstly, we have identified copper theft as organized crime. Copper theft is not something that is done by your small criminals and your it is organized in nature. So what we have done together with the police, we have then said that we need to target the market. We need to target where these guys are selling these things, because by targeting the market, you will start seeing effects in terms of your reductions in terms of copper. And I think this is one of the things that is paying off. We have joint operations together with the police based on intelligence that has been gathered by your SSA and crime intelligence, and this is starting to pay off. And that explains the decrease in terms of the decrease that I spoke about. That shows that at least they say we had the decrease in terms of incidence of copper cable. The other issue is that we're enhancing our Transnet nerve centers, and we were analyzing our situations on a daily basis. And by having that intelligence analysis done by our nerve centers, we actually are able to know which ones are our hotspots, and we address those hotspots because of the analysis that we get. The other issue that we're busy with, we're exploring appropriate security technologies for deployment in open infrastructure. We're looking at the acquisition of UAVs. We're also looking at putting in cameras in your open infrastructure. Because if you talk about the rail track itself, just the railway line, you talk about more than 3,000 kilometers of line. You cannot, if you have to put patrol teams to patrol at 3,000 kilometers of rail line, it will mean you'll have to put about, possibly if it was in the army, they'll talk about two battalions or whatsoever. But if you have the correct technology, for a distance of about 50 kilometers or whatsoever, sometimes you need about 4 cameras. Once you've got the 4 cameras, what you need to put in place is a response team, so that if anything is detected by your nerve center, then you have a team that can respond at the same time. So that is what we are looking at. We're also conducting awareness campaigns together with our CPF, the community policing forums, and this we're doing through Transnet Foundation. Foundations, we've put up a center in Springs, especially in our hotspot, which is manned by members of the community policing forums. And we're putting another center as well as Transnet in Kuma in the Stilfontein. This center will be manned by both members of the community policing forums, the police, and also Transnet security. So this center generally has been placed in the hospitals themselves. So that in itself, it helps us a lot in terms of reducing crime. There's community participation, and the communities that are involved in these centers, they are really helpful. We are also conducting ongoing judicial awareness campaigns to empower prosecutions regarding the veracity of the cable safety. One problem that we have with both, I'll talk about both the police and Department of Justice, is that the police have, the target of the police is to reduce contact crimes by between 7% and 10%. Generally, that keeps the police very busy. So if you talk about cable theft to the police, it's not part of contact crimes. So they're not generally judged on the basis of such crimes. So unless you engage the police, then they wouldn't understand exactly that what is the problem in terms of your proper cable, because they have contact crimes that they must deal with. It's the same issue when you deal with justice. Justice, we'll have to understand the seriousness of contact crimes. We were happy quite sometimes, I think about 4 months back, that for the first time in the history of South Africa, an accused person was sentenced to 12 years for copper cable theft in Kroonstad. And if you follow, why was the accused sentenced to 12 years? Because we were told that 2 weeks before that accused appeared in that court, there was a power outage for the last 2 weeks. So the magistrate must have been very angry because that affected him as well. And the accused was given 12 years. And I think we're starting to see some serious sentences in terms of our judicial, our courts in line with that thing. And what we need to do, maybe we need to encourage the courts in understanding exactly the seriousness of and what it does to the economy of the country. I think we need, so this judicial awareness campaigns that we are conducting from Transnet Security is on the basis of that, just making the justice aware of our problems. The other issue that we're engaging with is the sharing of intelligence together with other state-owned companies. There's a forum where we sit together, where we share information, because one thing that we have realized as state-owned companies is that we are faced with the same problem, and possibly we are facing the same suspects. So we need to come together and address this thing together, and I think we are achieving that. Possibly we will start seeing some reductions in terms of that thing. We also participate in South African Chamber of Business to spread awareness through their networks. Business Against Crime is one of our is one of the groups that we're working with, especially in terms of assisting us in, you know, with operations with the police whatsoever. In conclusion, I would like to say that the consequential rent value loss due to cable theft, it far exceeds the cost of loss for Transnet. You see, the consequential loss in terms of your cable theft is that once there's a cancellation of trains, that in itself, even though you cannot put an exact amount of money that has been lost, but it tells you that the impact is quite huge in terms of the economy. And this generally comprises of your train delays, your cancellations, your demurrage costs, your cost to replacement equipment like your locomotive pantographs, your labor costs, safety and injury to personnel. And the other thing that it causes us is generally, like I said, is about your reputation to your clients, because the fact that your trains are not in time and there's a lot of delays, that in itself it creates some reputational problems for the company. I think the biggest problem relates to non-service theft, and this has been scorpions like your I've just said it, your smelters and your, so it is organized in nature, and if we have to win the battle, like I said, we need to address the market itself, and I think we're winning. I'll give you one example. Because of the disruptive actions that we're doing in some of the marketing springs, one owner of the scrapyard even called us before this guy wanted to sell copper to him, and he said, hey, you know, I don't want problems with the police. So he called us and he said, can you identify, is this your copper? We said, yes, this is our copper. And he said, the guy is coming. So we even arranged for the police to arrest him. So that in itself, it shows the effect of this disruptive operations, that the guys that are selling copper as well, they start feeling the pinch in terms of police actions. And in these police actions, the SOCs are involved together with Transnet. And I think during the past 5 years, security efforts has increased dramatically. But however, the copper still increases, but we'll deal with it. And we have a committee, like I said, that involves the Hawks and everybody. And we're saying that legislative initiatives are required in order to assist the police and cause enforcement and harsher punishment in order to serve as a deterrent for the theft of copper cables. Some people I know were suggesting in the past to say that why can't copper theft be classified in terms of your crimes as a crime of sabotage whatsoever? Because then in that case, what it will do is that it will carry stiffer penalties, and in that case, it might reduce the scourge of copper theft that we have. I think that's one, maybe the suggestions that I will also suggest to this committee, that we should not rely on individual magistrates to give the guys harsher punishment. I think if it is declared a serious offense, maybe up to an extent that it is regarded as an offense of sabotage, I think in that case it will also help us a lot in terms of the decrease in terms of copper theft. I think that is, Chairperson, I think that is all from my side. Chairperson, can I just introduce our chief executive, Mr. Siyabonga Gama, the chief executive of Transnet Freight Railways, just joined us now. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Gama, welcome. Anything that you want to add? Don't worry, Mr. Gama is well known here in Parliament. He's a good friend of ours. It's good to see you again, Chief. Anything you want to add?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and I'm sorry that I got delayed. there isn't really much that one needs to add, except I think to just add impetus to the notion of labeling cable theft as economic sabotage, because it's not really the cost of the cables that is problematic. I think what really happens is that the competitiveness of our economy is really very much compromised as a result of these acts of sabotage, and therefore the supply chain of our country and our ability as a country to compete in global markets, it's severely curtailed as a result of this. So we do want to see that it becomes economic sabotage. And we've seen that with the Caltrain, it has actually elevated, the issue of cable theft. Because when we were complaining as a freight railway, nobody really listens, but I think if there's something as exciting as the Gautrain that gets affected. You can see that it's being elevated. But this has been happening for a very long time, and we need to make sure that these syndicates are actually curtailed. What we also see is that when the price of copper actually goes up, the incidence of these incidents take place. So even though the incidents themselves are decreasing, we find that more and more they are stealing longer cable. So you would see that there is quite a correlation between the high price of copper, and therefore that is why we're saying these syndicates that are very, very organized. This is not just Joe Soap on the street, but these are highly organized gangs, and we would look at the legislature to assist us in terms of creating the enabling legislation that would make sure that those that are caught, they actually get very severe sentencing. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Gama. Honourable members, it is now Kureisa. Open to you. Honourable Cunningham.
Why do you think went wrong with Cope? Cope normally speaks first, and Cope is silence is boring. You think they're preoccupied?
Can't answer you on Cope, but maybe for tonight, for things, TA and Cope can get together and sort that out.
Chairperson, this is quite a nice presentation, but you sort of move in against the trend of cable theft and copper theft, and you seem to have the whole issue under control because, in effect, you've halved your cable theft. Is this since the general took over, or is it the loyalty within the firm? Because very often one finds, as the police general said, they had to take serious steps against their own people. So I'm asking what you're doing, and if you then catch anybody within your system, do you just fire them, or do you criminally charge them as well? Then the stats about your network, I have difficulty in understanding that you have 3,000 kilometers of. And it's not the 3,000 kilometers that worries me. I think it must be more. So, and then you say you've got 4 cameras per 50 kilometers with the response team. Is that all over the country or just in the hotspots? And then you say in the hotspots you've got strings, but also one more. And this loyal team that you have, are they sort of taking the place of the old railway police, or is it a new group that you bringing in? And I'm just a little bit worried because you say you've got 200 new guys going for training in July. So I'm not so sure that your team, the existing team that brought down the theft, whether they are the new team that's going to do the work afterwards. Where did you find the first team that did the work? Or is it that team that's now being officially trained? Thank you, sir.
Honourable Sinclair, there's a worry that you have been pretty occupied. It's not another court case. Oh, okay.
Thank you, Chair. I'm happy that the DA acknowledged you, the leader and the coalition, you know. For me, collectively, we must get to a point where we get a resolution about how we're going to take this forward. I mean, we all acknowledge, even Transnet, you know, says it's one of the biggest challenges and so on. And the answer, once again, lies in the issue about addressing the market. We must stop the market. That is the big challenge. And The gentleman from Transnet was here, but I don't think the CEO was here when we raised the issue to say part of the solution to this challenge is that we must approach the PTI to put regulations, to promulgate regulations that prevent copper from this type of sources to go out specifically to these targeted countries like your China, like your India, like Korea. And it seems to me that the solution to our challenge is starting to hinge on that first. But the second issue is the one about the judiciary. And how do you deal with that? Now, I think all of us are happy to hear about the 12-year sentences and so on, but once again, we're back to the issue that the Department of Justice is not today here to assist us with coming to a very, very substantial solution to this challenge. And I think Transnet, with due respect, is many times in the cold face of this challenge when they can't get product to their destinations, when commuters get irritated and agitated and so on. So it's a collective solution that we must try and seek, but it seems to me it hinges on these two issues. Stop the market and do a better legal process in the judiciary.
It seems to me that most of the other counterparts should follow Transnet role in getting the ex-soldiers, but not just ex-soldiers, high-ranking soldiers in to Mr. Gama. I don't know how did you get to that idea, but it seems it's working because you've got the decision makers that can order the troops to go, and the gentleman was just saying to us, Brigadier or General was just saying to us that it's impossible to patrol 3,000 kilometers of line. But it seems to me that soldiers are walking. Even on Border Patrol, they are walking. So it seems to me that Transnet has got special soldiers that walk. But over to you to respond to Honorable Evans. You're fine. Okay. Honorable Maine, you're fine. There's no cable theft in Northwest on that line. You're fine. Okay. Over to you.
First, thanks, Chairperson. Generally, what we're doing, I can't say that it is because of the generals that are there. I think what the generals that are there did was just they just brought some new initiatives. You see, the one issue that I will raise in here is that because the police were not brought in line for all these other years, that is why there was a problem in terms of dealing with this. But the new strategy that we came with is that we engage the police directly. Like, for instance, last year we had most of our cable theft last year was taking place in the Mpumalanga area, Nelspruit, Witbank, whatsoever. What we did, we then engaged the provincial commissioner of the police office, and out of that we formed a committee between ourselves and the police in Mpumalanga. I can assure you that some weeks or even some 2 weeks or so, sometimes you go without a single incident of cable theft taking place in that area. Sometimes it will be two, you know, in the past you'll have about 8 incidents a week. This nowadays sometimes it goes up to 2 incidents a week whatsoever. So that in itself, I think it is helping us a lot. So we are engaging the police, and where possible, the police are very, they are quite helping in terms of this. So I think it is our collaboration with law enforcement agencies that generally helps us to bring down the copper theft. And I think we've also including our collaboration with other SOCs as well, it is quite helpful. So I think generally that is one of the reasons why we are starting to see a decrease in terms of our copper theft incidents. And we want to approach the police in other provinces. Like, for instance, generally, if you look at your copper cable theft, our hotspots now, I will say that they're generally in your Gauteng area and your KZN area. So we need to engage the police in both provinces as well, so that we bring it down. But our disruptive actions on the
on the market itself, I think it is also showing some decreases. And on firing those that have been caught stealing from us, yes, we do fire them, and I think General Walker will tell us criminal charges relating them. Yes, so we also lay criminal charges against those that are stealing from us, especially our members that are stealing from us. I think that's part of the discipline that we discipline management that we apply. And bringing the old railway police, I don't think that is generally replacing them. No, we're not planning on replacing the railway police. Actually, we'll work closely with them. It's just that what we are doing is that generally there are certain things that the security guard can do, and which he cannot do, but which the police can do. So I think we'll need the collaboration with railway police. So there's no plan of replacing railway police. I think we're actually working together with railway police, and we'll continue working together with railway police. And the 200 that we're bringing in, I think the first training, it will start sometimes in May and June. We're planning to deploy them in the different hotspots by 1st of July. Generally, and well, our target generally will be your school leavers and also your MSBs from the defense. These are the people generally that we're looking at in terms of bringing them into our in-house capacity. And the centers. These are not the only two centers. We also have some centers in Polokwane, in Polokwane, and we also have one in Mambuga. I think it's in the KZN, next to Richards Bay. I think that one we are opening that one. It was supposed to be sometimes in December, but I see it has been postponed again. So we are building this centers, community centers in the hotspots, and they will also assist the police in the community in terms of other things. We are also reducing the workload, especially in terms of the police, because then your affidavits and whatsoever can be done and certified at those community centers whatsoever. So it's a community involvement of some sort. But we put them strategically in our hotspots, then that in itself, it helps us reduce our incidence of crime, especially cable theft. I think I've answered all. Unless you have one question.
No? It's just a comment with regards to the amount of kilometers. I think it's over 30,000 kilometers. And with regards to the issues of cameras being installed within a radius of 50 kilometers, it was just an example. The correct stats still have got to be verified. The issue is that not all lengths and breadths of the rail can be covered with human bodies. So at some stage you'll have to improve and have technology. So combination of both will do.
Dr. Gama? Probably just to add, I mean, what we haven't indicated also is we also have aerial intervention in terms of what we call the eye in the sky, where we've got particular types of helicopters that go through some of these hotspots. The hotspots, there are very few areas in the country that are not hotspots. For us, I think the cost to have the different preventative measures, it continues to go up, and therefore I think we really
welcome the members' intervention in terms of saying the DTI and the judiciary need to be at the forefront in terms of assisting us with the preventative measures. But also I just wanted to clarify something around the railway police. We do have the railway police. In the main, the railway police intervention at the moment is really through passenger. They assist a lot with PRASA to prevent crimes in terms of moving trains, either long distance or short distance trains. What we're looking at here with these new security teams, as General Tuka has indicated, we have a combination of school leavers as well as reserves in the army. We're trying to bring about greater discipline in the security cluster. Because I think if you have army reservists, you'd know that they are disciplined. They don't normally go on strike. I said normally, advisedly. So you have a team of people who are not likely to try and steal from the company. At the moment, what we have is contracted security personnel. They are not all bad apples, but there are some bad apples amongst them, and they also typically move between security companies. And we want to basically nip that in the bud and have career employees that can at least look after the very key points, the key installations within Transnet, which would be both at the pipeline level as well as key installations in terms of the railways. So they would complement any work that the railway police do, because sometimes they work on the same sort of networks. But we want a similar type of discipline among security personnel as you would find in the security police.
Honorable members? Nothing?
Chairperson, I'm very interested to know. I thought that the training would be something more than just security officials. And what does it entail? I'm trying to get to a level where giving me enough reason to understand why you have reduced your cable set by 50%.
Maybe I should answer that question. The program that the general is indicating is ongoing. As he says, we will deploy the first batch only in July. So it is not only because of that intervention, but I think, as we said, there is a battery of interventions that have taken place. Largely, our security personnel from the leadership of General Tuka and General Rakao. The generals don't sleep, by the way. It also helps to have the generals, because the people in the security department know that the generals will arrive at any time. they don't work only during the day, so it helps. But the work with the other SOEs like Telkom and Eskom and the SAPS, that increased visibility. It has made the criminals to be aware that they are being watched, and in certain instances we are ahead of them. Most of the time in the past, they were always ahead of us. So I think there's a reversal in terms of those roles, and I think that in itself has helped. But also with the community policing forums, we do a lot of work even around schools so that communities can begin to understand the impact of this crime even on them, so that they can take greater ownership in terms of the success of some of our operations. And so communities have also been assisting in terms of assisting to identify you know, criminals and even potential criminals, and sometimes counseling people in terms of the impact of some of those actions.
Okay, honorable members, any more? Nothing from your side. So you're quite happy with Transnet. Mr. Gaba, you said that the general doesn't speak. I wish to see a general that walks in the night. They just form troop, where are you? Colonel, where are you? But no, it's good. And I think that, you see, Justice Department did not come because we wanted them to be here, because I think the big problem is in that sector, in terms of the lenient sentencing that they, or the NPA, as we have also heard this morning and as we have also harped on, is that prosecutors look at this and they think that, oh, this cable is worth 20 rand. So we're not going to go. But the impact of that, it's worth 20 million, 2 million disruptions of your FMCG or something that doesn't get to the destination on time. And you know, with certain stores and certain places, that if the product does not get on time, if you look at a store maybe like Woolworths, if the product does not reach Woolworths on time, they reject the product. So it goes further down the line in the value chain where disruptions are normally are. But we will definitely get the NPA down or Justice to ask. They must give us clear answers. And how do they think? Because they think that a cable theft or copper theft is just as stealing a loaf of bread, which is not in the same category, because it disrupts lives. It disrupts a whole lot of lives. But thank you very much, Transnet, for a presentation. Well done. We're proud of you. And if there's any more space for your recruitment drive, I think Honorable Van Linger would love to join them as one of the reservists in that, or she will get people that can join up. But are the public made aware, schools, FETs, all those, are they made aware of what is happening, that you can recruit or they can join up or Transnet to become security officers and that? Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Gama, and the generals. And generals, I hope to see you out there one morning. We will come out there one morning to do some oversight. No, but thank you. Thank you very much. And all the best and for your work and the endeavors forward. Thank you very much. Honourable members, it is now 22:01. I know at Parliament we don't belong into a union to say that 1 o'clock is lunchtime or so on is lunchtime. Enterprise is here. Should we take them? Department of Public Enterprises. Okay. DPE, are you ready? You ready? Or you would prefer after lunch? After lunch. So you're also hungry? Oh, okay. Well, no, we can finish earlier. Because DPE is not briefing us on solar water heater. It's only on the cable theft, copper theft. And they have requested to do a presentation after lunch. But if energy is ready, won't be with solar water heaters, how long will that take? Or Eskom? Who? Eskom? Solar water? For the next 30 minutes? Okay. We'll take Eskom with the solar water heaters, Honorable Van Linger. Is that fine with you? Wonderful. Okay. Thank you.
what may I do? I'll let them come with it. Yeah, they are.
Hi, how are you? Fine, thank you.
Order. General, we can still keep you here, don't worry. We can still keep you here, Chief. ESCOM is ready, so ma'am, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Solofelo Molefe from ESCOM. I'm responsible for customer services that includes demand management. With me here today is Andrew Etzinger. Andrew is the head of demand side management. He is tasked with ensuring effective and efficient rollout of the solar water heater program. Chair, just in terms of introduction, our brief as we understand it is that the committee would like to get progress on how the solar water program has progressed in terms of installation. So we will just take you through that and lessons learned and what the way forward is in terms of that. Chair, by way of introduction, I'm sure the committee is aware that government has given a target of 1 million systems to be installed by end 2014. From an ESCOM perspective, we've had an MYPD-funded program of about 446,000 units, with that remaining additional 554,000 units that would come with the to make up the 1 million target. To date, approximately 230 systems have been installed. Based on an ESCOM rebate program and also funded by the DORA funded, which is the Distribution of Revenue Act. We have still about 800 systems to be installed, and according to our calculation, Chair, it would probably take on average 22,000 systems to be installed on a monthly basis. The program going forward is now being led by the Interministerial Project Steering Committee, which has been chaired by the Director General of Economic Development. The DOE is part of that, ESCOM is part of that, National Treasury as well as other key players. Chair, just in terms of the next slide, we're just showing to you there's two different types of systems. We have the low-pressure installations, as you can see that how they look like. We also have the high-pressure installations. As you can see, that there's different types of technology within this space, and they have progressed in terms of improvement over time. In terms of the installations that we've had to date, this diagram provides an overview of where we started in 2009, a very low intake, and as you can see, that by 2011, we were close to 140,000 installations, both on the low pressure and high pressure program. And secondly, obviously, has been stimulated over time by the rebate that has been in place with regards to this. Okay, the next graph just highlights installations to date by region. As you can see, that there has been quite a huge uptake within the Gauteng area, as well as the Eastern Cape and Mpumalanga. Equitable share around the provinces has been a challenge, and largely due to the fact that these are really stimulated by the active participation of the energy services company within the region. So you can see that in Gauteng, Eastern Cape and KwaZulu-Natal, there has been quite a huge activity in terms of installation. And these obviously also include both ESCOM-funded rebate and the DOE-funded programs. As you can see with the red highlighting the DOE-funded programs. Some of the lessons we've learned from this is that we've identified that in terms of electricity saving, the systems themselves, the units, are quite expensive. If you look at the amount of money that we're actually spending, with very little saving in terms of demand, saving from a megawatt perspective, and also in terms of energy. I think just to give an indication, and I will get to the slide 11, I think the 1.1 million solars would probably get cost us about close to 4.9 billion with very limited savings, which I will share with you later on. We've also seen that the quality of installations in some instances has not been up to standard, where we've seen that there has had to be rework in some instances in terms of the installation. Rigorous process controls are required. That has been one of the major challenges around even the energy services companies that we're working with around the recovery of the funds or costs from ESCOM. We've had some control challenges around that. Contracts for ongoing maintenance as well is an area that needs to be looked at, particularly on the low-pressure system. Safety is also a serious concern and is non-negotiable. We've had some of the employees or staff members working for the installers falling off scaffolding, for example, as they try and install these. And we take this seriously from our side. I think in terms of way forward, Chair, I think, as I said, that now the Inter-Ministerial Project Steering Committee is looking at the future rollout of this program. And they have looked at a number of things in terms of how we can move forward. Just in terms of contracting, I think the important thing is that we would like to move away from installation based on energy services companies coming forward, but rather move to a contracting approach. Just in terms of, from a government perspective, it would ensure that we have proper, it would stimulate job creation and also sustainability of the industry itself. It would promote black economic empowerment. And I think the key thing as well is to support supply development and localization. We've seen that in most cases, most of these have actually come from international companies, where energy services companies are actually have agreements some of these, let me say, are probably imported units through agreements with companies like in Korea and China and so forth. You've noted, I think, in the previous slide that there hasn't been a proper equitable share per province. That also needs to be taken into account, and that also to make sure that we support localization, job creation, and skills development, we would have to obviously set aside for co-ops to get involved, and that specific targets will need to be met, and there should be certainty around those targets. I think from a market participant perspective, I think financing is very important, but also predictability and certainty within the industry. In terms of the implementing agents, I think, as I said, rigorous controls and governance is also important to make sure that there's adequate controls in place and to minimize the level of misappropriation and maladministration. Quality, very important as well, as I've talked about the fact that some of the units have had to be reworked in the past. System sustainability and safety also very important. Okay, this slide also gives a view of over the next 3 years, and in fact maybe the past 2 years have gone past, but a five-year view of what the 1 million target would provide us in terms of the cost as well as the demand saving and the annualized energy saving in terms of gigawatt hours. You will notice that in the first one you have your low pressure units. We've estimated about 800,000 over the 5 years, close to 3.9 billion it would cost, at a megawatt saving reduction of only 80 over the five-year period, and total energy savings of 420. And clearly that shows you that these are costly systems, and obviously the important thing for us is to make sure that we maintain the industry And therefore, it was important that we work with key government stakeholders to make sure that we sustain the industry going forward. The high-pressure system, as you can say, we've estimated 200,000 out of the 1 million, just over a billion rand, with a total energy saving of 511 in terms of gigawatt hours. A total of 1 million would then cost us on average about 4.9 billion. And as you know, that the, in terms of the Minister of Finance, the fiscals would then be able to fund quite a large portion of these, I think close to about 4.7 billion. The next slide just gives an indication of the work that has been going through the Interministerial Project Steering Committee. They have looked at a number of options that need to be explored in terms of the key parameters of rolling out the project. And what you see highlighted in the green are really the preferred option of the steering committee itself. I think from the contracting options, they have looked at a number of options. The 10 key contracts would be one of them. However, this really doesn't help from an SME perspective, who do not necessarily have a very strong balance sheet to be able to support the implementation. Therefore, the preferred method would be, option would be to have separate contracts both for manufacturers as well as installers, and also look at the option of contracting with co-ops where used. They would actually get free issue of these units for them to be able to install within their communities. The methodology for contract allocation, the preferred method is to look at an open tender process that would also support supplier development and localization, and also be able to deal with the equitable share of the units per province as well. They have looked at the conversion of the municipal memorandum of understanding, converting them into contracts, but I think the open tender one would be much more favorable. And also in terms of the allocation of systems, I think importantly the designated communities and co-ops is the preferred method. As I said, it would actually assist within the provinces and the communities to stimulate skills development and job creation. I've mentioned localization. I think what's important for us is to make sure that we have as many of these made locally, and it's important that we actually support even the rebate programs, that a premium should actually be given for those that are actually manufactured locally. So we would have a gatekeeper in terms of localization that would say a minimum level of local content for the systems would be necessary for the installers and manufacturers to be able to qualify. And in terms of the sustainability of the systems, we're looking at guarantees and provisions required, because it's important that we have sustainable systems. Contracts for system maintenance in place as well is very important, because after they've been installed, you want to have a maintenance plan for those systems, and also looking at carbon revenues that could be leveraged. So in terms of the system specification and installation requirements, I think safety, as I've mentioned, it is very important. It should be a prerequisite, full compliance to the Occupational Safety and Health Act, and also from our perspective, the ESCOM safety requirements are important. Compliance with national standards such as the SEN standards. Installation specifically only on low LSM houses. The preferred is that you actually need to maximize the size of the units, particularly if you think about the savings in terms of energy on a daily basis. I think for a unit that size, you could save 4.5 kilowatt hours per day. The solar systems themselves should carry an SABS mark approval from a quality assurance perspective. I think it's important as well to look at the structure, such as the roofs where these are being installed, to make sure that they are solid. Permanent water connection and water quality, I think the quality of the water and the availability of the water is very critical. Otherwise, you these systems become useless. And in terms of the scope of work for installation, for the installers themselves, installation and maintenance in addition, I think in addition to installation, the maintenance of the solar water themselves become very critical, and therefore the suggestion is that there should be at least a five-year maintenance plan. The installers need to be trained. There must be a proper training and development plan, you know, just like for your normal installation of your normal geysers, you require accredited plumbers to be able to install. It's important that even for these units, we have accredited installers who have gone through proper training and also have the CETA approved. A minimum of 70% of local community labor to be trained and employed for the installation. Quality assurance, as I've said, is very important, and it's important that there's all regular audits being done on the quality of these systems. And also, I think the installers must also be able to be easily accessible to the owners 24/7, and that's what we mean by call center establishment, so that if there are any technicalities, they can make themselves available. Progress reporting will also be very important to monitor the rollout from a quality perspective as well. And I think database collection and the form administration will also be important, just to make sure that we have some successes here. Chair, I think we will take some questions at this point. That's where we would like to stop.
Thank you very much, man. Mr. Ettinger, you want anything you would like to add?
Chair, no, nothing to add. That's just fine. Thank you. Any questions?
Members, it's over to you. I will label.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I'd like to know, I'm very impressed to see that Gauteng has been covered in. I live in Gauteng and I haven't seen one, so I'd like to know which areas has been done, please. And then also, if the rework has to be done, who carries that cost? And maintenance, because these units are being installed, and who maintains it afterwards if there's anything wrong? And the roofs, to reinforcement of roofs, who pays for the reinforcement of roofs? And is there a mentorship program for the co-ops? Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, ma'am. This is really a very good presentation. You've done the maintenance cost. You've referred to a lifespan, I think, if I understand it correctly, but it seems to me a bit short, because I think I saw 2 to 5 year maintenance plan. Does education and consumer development go with your maintenance plan? Because that is absolutely essential, that the user, the end user, understand what the system is like, how it works, and what can happen. And I really am a bit concerned that the lifespan is only, or your maintenance plan only goes on for 5 years. And again, I think my colleague referred to it, she said, who does the maintenance plan? In the contracting approach, until now, there has been, all the geysers have been installed through a municipal application, but we've had a couple of contractors who came and said, if you bring us a group, a pilot group in a specific area, we will help you. Then we again being told, no, you can only do it through your municipality. Now, is this going to change? Because in the townships, people can't fund that themselves. So that contracting company must have its own bridging loans or bridging funding to do what they have to do. Is this legal? Because a year ago I asked, and nobody could give me an honest and open answer. And then the water content. You know, at the coast we've got iron oxide coming into the boreholes and causing big drama. And if you mix that with water that has been that come from our dams, then the chemicals and that iron oxide
oxides from the boreholes don't speak to one another, and you get the problem that was in the papers this week from the Jeffreys Bay area. So I'd like to know how that situation is addressed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Chair, I was sensitized by the remark that the official from Eskom made regarding the value for money. What they're actually telling us with due respect is that we're not getting value for money in terms of the process that we follow, which is a very serious indictment on the program that was embarked on, because the underlying principle that we tried to establish was to address the demand side on the whole issue. So, in what I pick up is that as government and ESCOM, we don't get that getting value for money. The second issue is in terms of incentives. In the past, we saw that ESCOM is putting out incentives for heat pumps, which is once again trying to address the issue about how households manage their own electricity and so on. What is the situation there? We know that government is very supportive of this one, but if we want to bring our electricity consumption down, that is a very important incentive. And then I must say, from a Northern Cape perspective, I'm very happy to see all these developments. I don't know if it's because the minister is from the province, but maybe. But of concern is Limpopo. Limpopo is extremely low in terms of the rollout. What is the reason for that? Thank you.
I know, honourable members, that you want to go, but remember you've put questions and it needs to be answered. Ma'am, over to you.
Thank you, Chair. I think between myself and Andrew, we'll share some of the questions here. Chair, the question around the maintenance, the cost of the maintenance, in fact, the maintenance costs are incorporated into the cost of the unit itself. I think the issue around rework, there's really, I think in most cases, what we're saying is that the structure of the roof itself has to be solid when we go and implement. So it's something that we obviously would worry about. It's not a cost that has already been incorporated. So we obviously would have to look at the type of houses where we're installing and just make sure that it's solid, so that, you know, the last thing we want is to install that and then the whole structure, including the unit itself, it's not solid enough for that. I think the question on which areas maybe Andrew can take that specifically, there's various parts of the area in Gauteng where these have been implemented. The question on education and consumer development, I think it's something that we can look at. This education and training program is particularly for the installers themselves. But we do have, as ESCOM, quite a number of initiatives around education and awareness on energy efficiency, how they work and so forth. And the Solar Water Geyser program would be part of that. But the training program that I was referring to is particularly centers around the installers themselves. And I think maybe, Andrew, do you want to talk about the 5-year maintenance plan?
If I may come back to the first question relating to Gauteng, if I could direct members, Chair, to slide 7 once again, if I may. Which shows the breakdown of the number of systems per province. Sorry, back to 7. Right. Chair, on the blue areas indicates the uptake of ESCOM's rebate program. So these are claims which would come to us from throughout the province, not necessarily in any particular area. It would be right across the province in each case. The red area are those where there has been a designated area. In the case of Gauteng, it's been in Tshwane and a portion in Midrand. So that's been a small red portion on top, but from a blue portion, we can see that the uptake of Gauteng residents, just generally by contacting a supplier, contacting us through the website. That has been the one-on-one claims, the blue seconds, the one-on-one claims that basically have come through. The big areas where we have seen rollout is, in fact, just outside Tshwane as well. We're seeing massive adoption of systems in the Tshwane area. In terms of, if I may also at this time talk about Limpopo, as well as Mpumalanga, the reason that we are finding the uptake really low is again, up until now, we've depended on suppliers to bring projects to us. In the contracting approach, we are proposing a proactive approach where we will now be issuing tenders for provinces, and this is how we'll address this situation to make sure that we balance the skewed picture which is there. So this is really, as I said, market-driven forces which have resulted in that picture. I may have to talk about the water quality issue. I think that's very important. Water quality, in fact, has halted one of our rollouts in Naledi, where we once again have a hard water problem. And what we are certainly needing to do is, in terms of the rollout from here, test water quality in areas before we roll out solar water heaters. And this is why we stress the point within the presentation that water quality is essential. If your water quality is too hard, it will simply eat through the steel structure of your solar water heater within a year or two, so it just won't last. The 5 years, we have, at the moment, the responsibility for the maintenance and upkeep of the solar water is with suppliers, but we would feel more confident if the uptake were, if the maintenance were actually specifically contracted for, just to make sure that the suppliers stick around within the communities and this becomes a viable business, not to just install systems and then move on. And this is why we particularly want to contract for maintenance. At least 5 years is what we've said. What we also wanted to do, and this was referred to, ma'am, in the presentation, is look at carbon revenues. Most of our solar water heaters are, in fact, registered on the world's first solar water heating carbon program, which means that this revenue stream for suppliers for the next 10 years. So it's a 10-year program of basically obtaining income for working solar water heaters, which provides an additional incentive for the system to be maintained over a 10-year period. So that's certainly the way that we would be looking to go on the program. In terms of heat pumps, we certainly recognize that heat pumps is a very good technology. It is difficult to say which is better, solar water heating or heat pumps. Depending on which expert you ask, they're going to give you different answers. From our point of view, we would like electric geysers taken off the system as soon as possible, and it comes to the member's question about the cost benefits. What we recognize is that the importance of solar water heating is less about low-pressure solar water heating. This is low-pressure referring to rollouts on low-income homes. In those instances, the rollout is vital for the country, not for the purposes of electricity saving. I think that's what the presentation is saying. We concede that. But it is essential from the point of view of job creation and community upliftments and service delivery. And it's for this reason that we will effectively be splitting the funding of solar water heating. In the past, it was funded by NERSA through as a demand-side management contribution. That will not change. It will now be funded through the fiscus coming through. And once again, the motivation for that will not be electricity savings, but for the other benefits that I've mentioned. So I think there will be now clear separation. Heat pumps and other energy efficiency technologies will be funded through the demand-side management fund. Solar water heating will be funded as a service delivery job creation program. So I think that matter has now been clarified. Chair, in terms of the municipalities, certainly what we must do is, and I'm sure that Salva's presentation will cover this as well. We would like to see a tighter cooperation between municipalities and Eskom and government in the rollout of the solar water heaters. So there would certainly be consultation in terms of, firstly, which are the beneficiaries, and this comes back to, so provincial equity is one thing, but within a province, how does one then allocate within that province to municipalities, and within the municipality, how does one then allocate to beneficiaries within the municipality itself? It's a very, very complex issue, and I think that can only be resolved by government and SALGA. Once that is resolved, I think we can, from Eskom's point of view, project manage the implementation and the maintenance and all the necessary things from that. But allocation is vital, and this comes back to the heart of it. At the moment, we have a mix of municipalities who are wanting to go alone. In fact, municipalities received funding from the Fiscus outside of the ESCOM program, and I think this is what the member may be referring to, but from our side, I think it's quite clear in terms of the roles that ESCOM will not be involved in demarcating areas. That will be government and SELGA who will be doing that from now on.
Yeah. Sure. And I think maybe you mentioned the issue of affordability in the sense that some of these guys can't fund themselves. The rebate would still be applicable to them. What changes is actually the contracting approach, because currently you have just energy services companies entering into agreements with either municipalities or approaching us. So this would follow more of a much tender process. That is open to everyone, but the tender, the rebates would still be applicable.
Chair, there was a question on the co-ops and mentoring. Absolutely, and the approach that we are wanting to follow is to, on the contracting approach, split the procurement of the units from the installation and maintenance. And one of the requirements for the supply of systems to the program will be training and mentoring of co-ops and installers. So that will be an absolute requirement, which will be an ongoing requirement on the part of the suppliers to make sure that their systems are correctly installed. So that's very important to us as well. Thank you, Chair.
Hello, Fabian. Okay. If your colleagues will agree with you.
I can ask it online.
Go ahead, Honourable Fulingham.
Thank you, Chairperson. We've basically spoken about low pressure only. We haven't addressed the high pressure thing. And I want to know, are there rebates available, and how does one access it, and where do you get a credible supplier or installer or contractor? Because there are a lot of them. And then the price per unit is a scary thing. I think in all cases, and the imported units are cheaper. And my last thing is, I've got a thing about co-ops. Is this just trying to be, to do a job creation thing now? And is the system not going to fall flat on its face because we're now going to do it through co-ops and not through contractors, and the installation quality is going to go down? Thank you.
Ma'am?
Thank you, Honourable Member and Chairman. The rebate program for high-pressure solar water heaters continues, so there'll be no change to that. What we are looking to introduce, as Ms. Malefe explained, would be a differential on the rebate between imported systems and local systems to make sure that we give local systems, locally manufactured systems, a fair chance in the market, recognizing that we need to support the local industry. So that is currently on the cards. In terms of the systems, I think we have a complete list on the ESCOM website of all the suppliers. And the Honourable Member, I can sympathize. There are a lot of systems at different prices. And unfortunately, from ESCOM's point of view, we can't direct you to a particular supplier, of course, you know, for obvious reasons, but there certainly are a lot. The systems are relatively expensive relative to heat pumps, again. And I think the solar water heating industry needs to take a careful look at their competitiveness relative to heat pumps to make sure that they remain viable and that they prosper. In terms of co-ops, yes, the benefit from a co-op is, once again, we are wanting to create a sustainable solar water heating industry, which means that if solar water heaters are rolled out in a community, we need members of the community to be involved in the ongoing maintenance. It doesn't help that an installing company simply does installations and moves off. There will be no one locally to do the maintenance. And this is why we are keen on working together with co-ops, which would be a formal structure in a community to make sure that maintenance is done.
Okay. Seems to me you look satisfied on the whole funding. Thank you very much, ESCOM. Are you not satisfied with the question? With the answer? Sorry. You'll follow up. Okay, she'll follow up. But the co-ops, you've got a problem with the co-ops. That stuff. Sorry? Okay. The Youth League will address you during lunch in terms of co-ops. They will give you advice in terms of co-ops. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much, Eskom, for your presentation. We are breaking for lunch. We'll be back at 2:15, 14:15. You can leave your stuff. The venue will be locked. So we'll be back here at 14:15. Thank you very much.
What do you mean?